Case number 19-5176, United States House of Representatives Appellant versus Steven T. Mnuchin in his official capacity as Secretary of the United States Department of the Treasury et al. And number 19-5331, Committee on the Judiciary of the United States House of Representatives versus Donald McGahn II Appellant. Mr. Mupan for the appellant in number 19-5331. And for the appellees in number 19-5176, Mr. Letter for the appellant in number 19-5176, and for the appellee in number 19-5331, Ms. Barbero for the appellant in number 19-5176, and for the appellee in number 19-5331.
Mr. Mupan, we'll begin after briefly setting out the format we've adopted for today's consolidated argument, since we're conducting it remotely via teleconference rather than in person. As counsel are aware, each side will have 3 minutes to give an opening statement. After each counsel's opening statement, the court will proceed to questioning by the judges in order of seniority, except that I'll wait to pose any questions I may have until my colleagues have finished their initial round of questions. Then, any judge who wishes to do so will pose follow-up questions, again, in order of seniority. We will follow that format for each side, and both sides will have a brief rebuttal period. We'll now hear from Mr. Mupan for his opening statement in these cases on behalf of the appellant in the McGahn case and appellees in the Mnuchin case. Please proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. Disputes between the political branches about their institutional prerogatives have occurred since the founding, but lawsuits between them are a novel and unsanctioned tactic. It would be a radical break from historical tradition and controlling precedent for the federal judiciary to adjudicate the claims in these cases. Fundamental in both cases is that a dispute solely between the political branches is not a proper case or controversy under Article 3. Whether a plaintiff has the type of concrete injury that supports standing to sue, federal courts must look to whether the dispute is traditionally thought to be capable of judicial resolution within our system of separated powers. And in Raines v. Byrd, the Supreme Court emphasized that despite countless historical confrontations between one or both houses of Congress and the executive branch, no suit was brought on the basis of injury to official power, because such suits obviously exceeded the restricted role contemplated for Article III courts. Although Raines involved individual members of Congress alleging that their voting power had been diluted, those facts were not material to the court's broader legal reasoning, which this court is bound to follow, as the Department of Justice has consistently urged since Raines. In any event, there are additional case-specific reasons why each of these two suits is non-justiciable. As for the Mnuchin case, the House's claim is that the executive is spending beyond the statutory limits authorized by Congress, but that is merely a generalized grievance that the law is being violated, or at most an abstract objection that legislative power is being diluted. This court has consistently rejected attempts by federal legislators to bring such claims, and the claim here is particularly defective because it is brought solely by a single chamber of Congress, even though the Appropriations Clause vests authority in Congress as a whole. That is the type of mismatch that the Supreme Court held in Bethune-Hill forecloses legislative standing. As for the McGahn case, Congress itself has declined to provide jurisdiction or a cause of action that supports the House's suit. In 28 U.S.C. 1365, Congress authorized suits to enforce legislative subpoenas only by the and never federal executive officials asserting governmental objections. The House cannot circumvent these express limitations by invoking a purported implied cause of action in equity under the general federal question jurisdiction statute. The suit would not have been allowed even before Section 1365, and it is certainly foreclosed after that statute. Finally, adjudicating such interbranch disputes would shift power from the executive to the legislature and politicize the judiciary. Only legislative tools to ensure that he does, though those tools are abundant and powerful. Judicial intervention in this political tug of war risks damaging public confidence in the impartiality of the courts of this circuit. Instead, therefore, this court should adhere to its traditional limited role under Article 3, these suits. With that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mupon. Occasionally you're breaking up. Just if you can just please make sure to speak into the receiver so we can hear you.
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Judge Henderson?
Thank you. I have no questions for Mr. Mupon.
Thank you. Judge Rogers?
Oh, good morning, Mr. Mupon. We meet again.
Good morning, Your Honor.
As I understand the way this argument is to proceed, the court is first going to address the Mouton case and complete that and then turn to McGann. Am I correct about that, Chief Judge?
We're considering both cases together, Judge Rogers, so you're free to ask questions of both sides on either case as you wish.
I'd like to talk to you then, Mr. Mupon, generally about concepts and Supreme Court decisions. Our Constitution, we agree, has three branches. The third branch is specifically described in Section 2 of Article 3, quote, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the treaties or which shall be made under their authority. To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public, etc., to all cases. And the clause and section goes on to be specific. I'm focusing on the first sentence in terms of the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution. Striking to me in both of these cases is the fact that we are dealing with specific authorities that the Constitution has provided. And I think we agree that in terms of Article 3, we must, as the Supreme Court has pointed out, be wary in light of our concern regarding the separation of powers and the preservation of the balance of powers. In your view, then, on behalf of the department and your client, are you of the view that there can be no role for the court in terms of preserving the separation of powers?
Your Honor, I think that the key language that you read from Article 3 in that sentence is the phrase case or controversy. And what the Supreme Court has made repeatedly clear in cases, not just Raines, but in cases like Allen versus Wright and FEC versus Aikens and Spokio versus Robbins, again and again, the court has made clear that the meaning of the phrase case or controversy has to be informed by history and tradition of the sort of disputes that would have been traditionally understood to be resolved through the judicial process. And our fundamental submission here is that suits between the branches have never been understood to be that sort of case or controversy. Now, to be sure, the courts have an important role to play in preserving the separation of powers, but that happens, as has consistently and always happened in this country, in suits involving the rights of private parties, when private parties' rights and interests are implicated by a federal statute or a federal practice that implicates the separation of powers. That is when courts get involved, not when just the branches sue each other. That has never happened.
So you import into Article 3, Section 2, a provision that Section 2 only applies to cases brought by private parties?
It's not just private parties, Your Honor. It all, of course, the sovereign itself, you know, the United States or a state, that too is the type of suit that has long been recognized. Our basic point is that cases or controversies have to be assessed based on history and tradition of the types of disputes that have been traditionally resolved by courts. And the type of dispute that has never been resolved by courts historically is a suit between components of the federal government asserting only their own official prerogatives and interests. That is what Raines described in three pages of history. There have been many disputes between the branches of that type, and courts have never resolved them.
So what do you make of the statement in Raines where it is summarizing its holding, and it points to four different factual contexts with which it was dealing, and concludes by stating, quote, whether the case would be different if any of these circumstances were different, we need not now decide, end of quote.
So what I make of that, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court had reasoning in its opinion, which I'll discuss in a moment, and then what it said is it left to itself the discretion to decide how the case would be decided in a different fact pattern. But that is not a license for this court to ignore the clear import of the reasoning that the court did adopt. In fact, Your Honor wrote an opinion on exactly this issue in the Oker decision, which we cite in our supplemental briefs. There, too, that case involved the Supreme Court's decision in Hubbard, and Hubbard held that federal courts are not a department or agency for purposes of the federal false statement statute. Hubbard had exactly the same caveat that you just identified, where it said we need not decide whether a given entity within the House might also be covered. But what Your Honor correctly ruled was whether or not the Supreme Court has left itself the ability to create an exception. It is abundantly clear from the Supreme Court's reasoning that in that case, the Department of Agency had to be an executive branch entity, and so the House committee was out. Here, the relevant analogy is if you go through the factors that the court identified in that paragraph you just identified, they said three things. They said, appellants have alleged no injury to themselves as individuals. So too here. They said the institutional injury they allege is wholly abstract and widely dispersed contra Coleman. So too here. This case bears no resemblance to the type of injury that was asserted in Coleman. And third, they said their attempt to litigate this dispute at this time and in this form is contrary to historical experience. Absolutely true here. As I discussed earlier, the history and tradition that the court talked about for three pages of opinion was not at all limited to individual members of Congress. They talked about how one or both houses of Congress had never sued, and they concluded the entire analysis with the following conclusion. It is obviously not the regime that is obtained under our Constitution to date. Our regime contemplates a more restricted role for Article III courts about protecting the rights of individual citizens, and it is not some amorphous general supervision of the operations of government. The reasoning of Raines, root and branch from top to bottom, forecloses this suit. It is true that the court has left itself the ability to create some new exception based on reasoning that doesn't appear in the opinion, but that is not open to this court as a lower federal court. This court has to take the reasoning that the court has given as on its own terms.
So, in your view, is the first factor that the court listed in Raines the key problem here, namely whether, the way the court phrased it, the institutional injury they allege is wholly abstract and widely dispersed? That's one part of it. And the second part is, and their attempt to litigate this dispute at this time and in this form is contrary to historical experience. So the question is, what historical experience means in that context? And I gather the department's position is the fact that the branches have been able in past times to work out their differences to their mutual satisfaction, namely accommodation, is irrelevant. And that while maybe, let's just go that far for now, losses have been brought, the branches were content to work out their differences by accommodation.
So I have 2 points in response to that question, Your Honor. So the first is, I think when you have to read that sentence in Raines, in Part 4, that's the conclusion of Raines. I think you should read it in light of what it's summarizing. So when they say, contrary to historical experience, I think what they're referring to is the 3-page-long discussion that starts on page 826 of the opinion that says, from several episodes in our history, in analogous confrontations between one or both houses of Congress and the executive branch, no suit was brought on the basis of claimed injury to official authority or power. That is what they're talking about. That sentence and the reasoning that follows applies four square here. As to the second part of your question, the suggestion that historically everything was fine because everything was handled through accommodations and there's some new change now, that is just simply not historically accurate. It is certainly the case that from the very first administration to this one, the branches have negotiated over information requests, and sometimes their disputes have been able to be solved that way. But it is also undoubtedly the case that from the very first administration through to this one, there have been times where the branches fundamentally disagreed, and at the end of the day, Congress did not get everything it wanted because the executive branch refused to provide it. And what we know is, for 200 years, Congress did not sue in those circumstances. It is not because Congress was happy every time or Congress was persuaded the executive branch was right. Anyone who understands what ambition checking ambition is all about understands that we have two branches that use the tools that they have to accomplish the ends that they seek to achieve. And many times that means that the executive branch said no to Congress and Congress dealt with that through the political tools it has, but it never filed a lawsuit to get that information. That is what the fundamental change here is, and it is foreclosed by the reasoning of Raines.
So, in terms of the balance of powers, where the underlying allegations are, there have been abuses of one branch's specifically identified constitutional powers. Namely, the power of impeachment and the power of the purse, that the courts are simply not available in your view. And this would be despite the Office of Legal Counsel opinion twice issued and never withdrawn, that where accommodation does not work, the tools that are left, in this case to the House, are simply inadequate to the task. And here, as you well know, in Mnuchin, actually a closure of government. So at that point, what are the options for the people? What did the framers have in mind, having both experienced what they abused, they viewed as abuse of powers by the king, and they were aware that certain limitations had been placed on the king in terms of his powers of the purse. So with that background and common law experience, why would the court need to acknowledge more than that the historical experience identified in Raines is not disputed, but it is not the total picture of the historical experience? And Raines itself didn't say and didn't imply and specifically acknowledge all of this could change if the circumstances were different. And then it went on to identify its specific holding. Why isn't a lower court entitled to take the Supreme Court at its word and discuss, subject to the Supreme Court review and possibly correction, those factors are different here and materially different here and critical to preserving the balance of powers and the separation of powers?
So there's a lot baked into that question, but let me try to make two or three points in response. The first is, I don't think that there is any material factual difference between the historical examples given in Raines and the situations that you have identified here. So take, for example, two of the examples that were given in Raines, the fact that no president ever sued over the Tenure of Office Act and the fact that President Coolidge was never sued over his pocket veto. Those two things were both challenges to interests of one or either branch, the president's ability to control the executive branch and Congress's ability to veto legislation. Those were alleged intrusions to the separation of powers. But the point that Raines is making is the fact that there might be a legal violation doesn't answer the question of who is the proper party to sue. And the point that Raines is making, which applies foursquare here, is that never had suits between one or both houses of Congress and the executive branch claiming injury to official authority or power. The reason why, to take a step back, is it's inherent in a system of separated powers that each branch may have a conflict when it's exercising some of its powers. Judges, for example, determine their own recusals. They also determine that they are absolutely immune from civil damages. Legislatures determine whether they're subject to their own laws. They've conveniently carved themselves out of laws like FOIA and the insider trading laws. And the executive department determines whether to prosecute executive branch officials. None of that means that the other branches can usurp their powers. For example, even in Morrison versus Olson, no one thought that Congress could make itself the prosecutor of executive branch officials. Rather, what means to have a system of separate powers is that when each branch thinks other branch is exceeding its powers, it uses its tools to deal with that. And the legislature has ample tools of a legislative variety to deal with the alleged violations here. But what the one tool it does not have and has never had is the ability to file lawsuits against the executive. Take, for example, the subpoena case. The Supreme Court in Reed expressed said that there is a wide difference between Congress's ability to issue a subpoena and its ability to sue to enforce a subpoena. And the reason why is because the ability to sue to enforce the laws is a quintessentially executive function. That's the Supreme Court's square holding in Buckley versus Valeya. Congress has undoubtedly the ability to issue subpoenas, but it depends on the executive to comply and enforce the subpoenas. That is the separation of powers. That is the checks and balances that the framers are talking about. That is what ambition, checking ambition, is all about. And it totally overrides all of that to say that if Congress is upset that its subpoenas aren't complied with or its statutes aren't complied with, it can just walk into court and file its own lawsuits.
I have many more questions, but we have agreed to share time. And I don't want to take more time, and I appreciate your responses, Mr. Mupan. But I will have another round of questions after my colleagues have had a chance to ask questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Tatel?
Good morning, Mr. Mupan. I want to start by asking you about the order the Supreme Court issued yesterday in Mazars and Deutsche Bank, where it asked the parties to address the question whether, quote, the political question doctrine or related eligibility questions bear on the court's adjudication of these cases. I realize it was just 24 hours ago, or even less, but I'm curious to know whether you think the political question doctrine, which haven't been raised so far in this case, bears on our resolution of these two cases.
Well, of these two cases, we are not asserting, we haven't raised a political question argument as such. Our argument is that this is not a proper Article III case or controversy. But just take, for example, the border wall case. We are not arguing that the merits of that question, the question of whether there is statutory authorization for the spending there, is a political question that a court is incapable of addressing if you had a proper plaintiff with Article III standing and within the zone of interest of the statutes they were seeking to enforce. So we're not making a political question argument here. We are.
But if this court disagreed with you about standing, would you have a backup political question argument or not?
No, we have not pressed a political question argument in either McGann or Mnuchin. No.
Okay. Thank you. I want to ask you two questions about your argument that that the courts can only address separation of powers issues when there's a private party involved. So in this case, which is titled Committee versus McGann, there is a private party, but as you point out, Congress is interested in Mr. McGann only in his capacity as former counsel to the president. Which leads me to ask you, isn't this case exactly like Mazars in that sense? Mazars was definitely a private party, just like McGann, but its only role in the case was because Congress was interested in obtaining the documents of the President of the United States that it was holding. So I'm curious, given that, if you could explain to me how your position in this case is consistent with your position in Mazars.
Sure. So I think the critical difference is that in Mazars, the president is the plaintiff there, and he is analogous to the congressman in Powell versus McCormick. And by that, what I mean is the president is undoubtedly a government official, and his claim arises based on his government office, but he is seeking to vindicate a personal interest because, as your honor is well aware, in Mazars, what he's seeking to shield are his personal records. That is analogous to in Powell versus McCormick, the congressman's interest in his salary and in his job. That was the personal injury that supported standing in that case and in the Mazars case, and that is what is critically lacking in this case, and that is what is critically lacking in Raines versus Byrd. And this is the whole first section of Raines versus Byrd goes through exactly this point, that when you have members of Congress suing in circumstances like this, unlike in circumstances like Powell, they are not seeking to assert any personal interest of theirs. They are seeking only to assert an institutional injury, an official prerogative. And that is the type of claim that has never been heard by federal courts with respect to federal legislators. And then the second step of Raines' analysis is they had only ever once heard an institutional injury of that type at all. It involved only state legislatures and in a very narrow factual circumstance.
circumstance. And so that's why this case doesn't bear any resemblance to the only times the court has ever heard an institutional injury by by legislators, and therefore it's governed by the third step of Reins' reasoning, which is historically they have not heard suits like this, and that's because they are not a proper case for controversy.
That isn't the way I read your briefs in Mazars. So you're arguing in Mazars that that is a classic separation of powers case that the courts cannot adjudicate, that the subpoena in that case will interfere with the president's official power, that is, his ability to do his Article II functions. That's your argument in Mazars.
Look, to be clear, it is certainly the case that the president's claim in Mazars is based on his holding office. But his interest, his injury that supports his Article III standing is a personal one. Just like in Powell versus McCormick, of course the congressman's claim was based on the fact that he's a congressman and that Congress couldn't expel him. But his interest, his injury, was to his pocketbook. The difference between what the injury in fact is that supports Article III standing and what the merits claim is that supports entitlement to relief.
Let me ask you a related question about this, about your argument that the courts can only adjudicate cases like this one as a private party. Suppose you're right about that, and that Congress is only power then is, or one of its own powers then, is to send the Sergeant at Arms to arrest Mr. McGahn, and then he files a habeas corpus. Isn't the amicus brief by legal scholars right that that would require the courts to adjudicate exactly the question you seek us not to adjudicate here?
No, they're not right for the following reason. It is certainly the case that Mr. McGahn, if he were arrested, would have Article III standing to file a habeas petition, but his first claim in such a habeas petition would be that Congress has no authority to arrest an executive branch official for complying with an executive branch order not to comply with a legislative subpoena. That is beyond the scope of Congress's power, even if the subpoena is, in the court's view, valid. The critical point, as we explained in our supplemental brief, is Congress doesn't have any express authority to go around arresting people. Its power to arrest is an implied power based on, as the Supreme Court described in Anderson versus Dunn, it's an ancillary to its legislation. It's based on history and necessity. And there is simply no historical support for the notion that they can arrest an executive branch official for following executive branch directives. It has happened twice after the founding, and both of those cases were set aside on other grounds.
Well, my time is up, so maybe I'll follow that up. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Garland?
Thank you. As I understand your position, even with respect to the Mnuchin case, even if the House and Senate together agreed to bring the suit, it wouldn't make any difference. They would not have standing. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that is so even if there were no other source of appropriated funds for the president to claim that the money is coming from. Still no standing.
That's correct, Your Honor. That would just be a claim that the executive was acting illegally, that the executive was acting in excess of any statutory or constitutional authority. And that is the sort of generalized grievance that this court has long recognized, even before Reins.
All right. And even if Congress had passed a law forbidding the expenditure of any money on any wall, same thing, no standing?
Yeah, to be clear, that, as I'm sure you're aware, that's obviously a hypothetical here. And there's
obviously hypothetical, and I have two more for you, so...
So we have never suggested that we would not comply with such a law, but it is our position that there would not be standing in that circumstance, just like there would not have been standing in Campbell versus Clinton if Congress had passed a statute that says...
I'm not questioning the merits here. I'm just asking. I'm trying to get exactly clear the scope of your argument. That's all.
Okay.
So that's the argument. All right, now here's a hypothetical. After the defeat of a health care bill, the President of the United States instructs the Treasury to pay for health care insurance for any American who cannot get private insurance. Would the Congress have the have standing to challenge that?
No, Your Honor. I'll just say no, and I hope at some point after I've answered the questions, I can get a chance to explain our reasons why, but no.
Would anyone have standing?
Someone would. There would only be standing in that circumstance if you could identify someone who could have Article III injury from that expenditure.
I'm trying to put this in the position of it only going to Americans who cannot get private insurance in any other way. Can you imagine anyone else who would have standing?
Off the top of my head, on that hypothetical, it's hard for me to think of one. That said, you know, these things, sometimes there are somewhat surprising people who would have Article III standing. I'm reminded, for example, of King versus Burwell, which this court I'm sure is familiar with, where in that circumstance the government was allowing people onto the federal exchanges, and it turned out that through complicated factual circumstances, there were actually certain people who were injured by getting the money. There's always some possibility that there would be someone who would have Article III injury.
You can't imagine one. This would be for any American who cannot get private insurance and who wants the money. So to take out whatever the technical issue was in Burwell.
Well, no, but look, Your Honor, for example, just to give something totally sort of artificial, you can imagine a hospital saying we're actually better off if people don't have insurance because, like, they run up more charges, right? Like, they're all,
you don't think that.
About it, but my only point is it's hard to answer in the abstract the question of whether there will be literally no one who has Article III standing, because all you need to do is find someone who has an injury in fact, and that sometimes can happen.
Has to be an injury in fact. It can't be speculative. It can't apply to everyone. So let me ask another question. After a new proposed Paycheck Protection Act fails, the President simply instructs the Treasury to send every American $1,000 a month until the pandemic ends. No standing, right?
Again, Your Honor.
Go ahead and speculate. Who do you think would have standing to challenge that? Everybody gets $1,000 a month if they want it. If they don't want it, they don't have to take it. What individual could possibly be injured by that?
It's hard for me to say right now, but for example, I could imagine like debt collectors and repo men might be worse off in that circumstance because people would be more able to comply with their debts. But again, I don't want to, like, I'm willing to stipulate that you could think of hypotheticals where the government giving people free money means that no one is injured. And my basic response to that point is the point that the Supreme Court has made in cases like Richardson and Schlesinger, which is there are going to be violations of law that don't injure anyone. And what that means is it is the type of dispute that is not resolved in courts. It is resolved through the political processes. You can think of lots of hypotheticals like this, and these were went through in cases like Richardson and Schlesinger, where it was hard to think of anyone who would be injured by violations of things like the Statements of Accounts Clause.
Yeah, well, this seems more important, respectfully, than the Statement of Counts. If the appropriations power can never be checked in a situation where the government just gives money away, either for health care or for maintenance, that's a significant power that the president has that can't be checked by the Congress. It's not the same as the accounts law.
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, I was answering your question directly, which is with their Article III standing. I don't agree at all with the proposition that there is no way to check such a thing. So, for example, on your hypotheticals, I would assume if you were acting in direct contravention of the federal statutes that restricted spending, the individual officers would be in violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act, which, as Your Honor knows, is a criminal statute. So the hypotheticals...
Justice Department... will take the position that, I assume, if the President orders the payment by the Secretary of the Treasury cannot be prosecuted. Isn't that the government's position?
I don't believe the department has ever taken that position with respect to a flagrant violation of a spending statute, a statute that was unambiguous on its terms and where the president just ordered a clearly illegal expenditure. I do not believe the department has ever taken that position. And more to the point, the question that really matters for purposes of your hypothetical is what would the next administration do? What would, after the president who orders a completely illegal expenditure of funds is out of office, is the next administration going to bring that criminal prosecution? Because that is the political deterrent that will stop any inferior executive official from engaging in the sort of illegal spending that you're talking about. So there are checks, Your Honor. There's not a check of a lawsuit.
So the president supplements his order to the Treasury with the following. One, an order to the Attorney General not to bring a case. And second, a pardon for any behavior pursuant to this order of the president. What's the check now?
So the check in that circumstance, I suppose, Your Honor, is to use all the other tools that Congress has against the president with respect to what the president's doing. So they could shut down his legislative agenda. They could shut down all of his nominations. Now, I suppose, Your Honor, can ask me in response to that, well, what if he violates all of that? And at that point, if you have a president in this hypothetical who is ignoring all laws, I suppose there's the final solution for that sort of problem is removal from office. But at no point is the proper solution for that to let Congress come in and file lawsuits against the president because, again, Your Honor, on these extreme hypotheticals you're talking about, it's a little hard for me to understand, as Justice Scalia pointed out in Windsor, why if you hypothesize a president who is recklessly violating all federal statutes and completely thumbing his nose at the article in all of Article 1, he will be brought to heel by a district court judgment. It's just not a very realistic hypothetical to assume that what's going to solve a constitutional crisis of the type you're hypothesizing is a federal lawsuit.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mupan. I appreciate the answers. I'm out of my time.
Thank you. Judge Griffith?
Good morning, Mr. Mupan. I'd like to ask a question, first of all, that relates to the McGahn case. And I think I'm picking up on the line of questions Judge Rogers was asking you. How is Congress to conduct its constitutional duty of oversight in the face of the type of utter disregard this administration has shown for that oversight? Hasn't this administration eschewed the traditional norms of compromise and negotiation that you rely upon in your argument so heavily?
No, so first of all, just as a factual matter, I don't think that that is correct, Your Honor. I don't think that...
Why? How? How is that not correct?
This administration, like past administrations, has taken every subpoena as they come by their terms and engaged in accommodation. Now, I think during the last...
I'm sorry. I thought there was an across-the-board directive from this president to not cooperate, to not testify.
That is not correct, Your Honor. It is not the case that... across the board, the administration is not complying with either legislative oversight subpoenas or even impeachment subpoenas. What was the case was that there were categories of impeachment subpoenas that were categorically improper in our view because either there had not been a House authorization for an impeachment inquiry or they were insisting on engaging in those investigations, depositions without agency counsel present, or they were trying to depose close presidential advisors. But there was never a blanket edict that we would not comply with any and all subpoenas, and certainly not on the oversight context. We have continued to engage in the accommodation process with respect to subpoenas.
What about with regard to this subpoena, Mr. McGahn? What was the response?
Honor, in this subpoena has two pieces to it. There was a document piece and there was the testimony piece. On the testimony piece, it is our position and has been longstanding position of the Department of Justice going back across administrations back to the 70s, every administration going back to the 70s, that
Congress cannot seek to compel the testimony of close presidential advisors. However, on the other part of the subpoena, the document piece of it, there was an accommodation, and the accommodation was reached. And this is laid out in the declarations that accompany that are in the JA, in particular the Pora Declaration. There was an accommodation that was reached with respect to the document piece of the McGann subpoena. Now, in the supplemental brief, they point out that they haven't yet received those documents. My understanding, and this isn't in the record, but I was when I saw that in the brief, I wanted to find out what was happening. My understanding is the accommodation that was reached, the substance of it was agreed to, and then there were procedural issues where they were linked to another production, and that the accommodation over that has still been ongoing. My understanding is no one is saying that we are in breach of the accommodation. That procedure has just been ongoing, and I don't believe the House has reached out to either the White House or to us about receiving the McGann document. But there is an accommodation in that, so it is certainly not the case that we have just refused to comply with all subpoenas. In fact, we've complied in part with this subpoena.
Okay, let me shift to the Mnuchin case, if I could. In your view, what's the narrowest ground on which we could resolve this suit?
The Mnuchin suit, I think the narrowest ground is to say that at a minimum, in a suit to enforce what they call the Appropriations Clause and what we would say are a claim that the president has exceeded his statutory authority in spending, that you would at a minimum need to have both houses of Congress. Because under Bethune-Hill, you need to have, if you have a legislature asserting an institution.
Yeah. If we agreed with you that's the narrowest ground, that Bethune-Hill is the narrowest ground, what are the congressional standing issues that we could leave undecided for another day?
So in the Mnuchin case, what it would leave, I think, would be the question of, well, what if it was Congress as a whole that had sued, which is the series of questions that Judge Garland, I think, started to ask me about. You would not have to answer the question of whether Congress as a whole suffers an injury, in fact, when the president exceeds his statutory authority, whether it be with respect to spending or otherwise. Now, to be clear, we think this court has already resolved that question in case of Chenoweth.
What do you make of the House's argument that this is a different sort of dispute, that this is more than just a claim that the president has exceeded his statutory authority, that this is a violation of the Appropriations Clause? What do you make of that argument?
So the fundamental problem with that argument is that the Appropriations Clause by its terms says no spending unless authorized by law. So an Appropriations Clause claim is always, always a claim that the president has exceeded his statutory authority.
Right. They don't argue that, correct?
I'm sorry. So
one of our judges has unmuted himself, and we can hear his comments. So I think that's just a technical glitch. Go ahead.
They do argue that. If you look at their complaint alleges it's without authorization by law. Of course that complaint includes that allegation. If they filed a complaint that said there's a violation of the Appropriations Clause, by the way, we have no idea whether there's any statutory authorization, the suit would have been immediately dismissed and they probably would have been sanctioned. You cannot claim an Appropriations Clause violation unless you claim there's no statutory authority for the spending. It is inherent in the Appropriations Clause claim that they're saying it's an excess of statutory authority claim.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, to demand.
Thank you, Judge Millett. And if I could make sure that the judges have their lines muted. Judge Millett.
Yes, thank you. I guess I won't mute mine right now, if that's okay.
Of course.
Mr. McGlynn, first of all, thank you for being here and for dealing with the challenges of telephonic oral argument. You have already, obviously, in your brief and in your argument here, relied very heavily on the discussion in Raines about sort of the history or lack thereof of these types of lawsuits, and have emphasized that as a lower court, we're bound by that think, 3 pages or around there of discussion. But more recently, in Arizona legislature, the Supreme Court has said, in no uncertain terms, that Raines held, quote, specifically and only, that individual members of Congress lack Article III standing, end quote. And if I were to conclude that that analysis was part of or essential to their reasoning in the case, wouldn't we as a court be bound by that reading of Raines?
Your Honor, we have never disputed that the factual posture of Raines is that it involved individual members of Congress, and so the square and narrowest holding is as Arizona described it. Our point is a broader one and a more fundamental one, which is that this court, as a lower court, unlike the Supreme Court, is required to follow not just the narrowest technical holding of a case, of the Supreme Court precedent based on its facts. It is required to apply the reasoning of the opinion and it apply the reasoning as
No, no, no. To be clear, if they had just said, this is their words, that it only held that. Now, in the United States was amicus curiae in this case, and I assume argued this Raines point there. Did they? Did you?
You know, I'm not sure, Your Honor, whether we did it or did
Let's
not.
Let's assume one of the parties argued it, and so that this language in the opinion is can be understood as a response to that argument.
Look, Your Honor,
What should we do? I just feel like we're getting kind of conflicting messages.
Well, I would say a couple of things, Your Honor. If you want to focus on Arizona State Legislature, I would focus on footnote 12 of Arizona State Legislature, where the Supreme Court made abundantly clear that what it held in Arizona did not extend to the federal context because of the separation of powers problems that would be created in the federal context. Further point out that if you look at footnote 12 and look at how it is phrased precisely, the phrasing is the case does not touch or concern the question whether Congress has standing to bring
it. All it says is that we're not deciding that, right? This doesn't decide that question, okay?
I'm just talking about
when you say what Raines said and what we're supposed to do, and then we have a Supreme Court come along saying specifically and only, and if we were then to write an opinion saying the Supreme Court told us we can't do anything, that there's because of two instances in which presidents chose not to bring lawsuits, the two instances that were discussed there, and some of the other discussion, that this void of experience means we can't adjudicate a case. We'd have to grapple with Arizona legislature, right?
I absolutely have to grapple with Arizona legislature.
Then you also have relied in your brief to us, your supplemental brief, on Justice Souter's concurrence heavily, which elaborates on this concept. But I assume you also rely on footnote 2 of his concurrence. We said it's also possible that the impairment of certain official powers may support standing for Congress or one house thereof to seek the aid of the federal judiciary. I assume you rely on that footnote as much as the rest of the Souter concurrence.
Well, actually, I think you're misreading the footnote and its location in the opinion. So
I just read it word for word.
Well, you did.
The appellant's note, it's also possible that the impairment of certain officials may support standing for Congress or one house thereof to seek the aid of the federal judiciary. You said I misread that?
I think you're misunderstanding the location of that footnote in his opinion. So if you look at...
Okay, but it says that. I thought you were saying I wasn't reading it.
What I'm disputing...
I wasn't reading it accurately. Okay.
So if you look at that footnote, footnote 2,
mm-hmm.
That footnote is attached to text, where Justice Souter starts his opinion by saying, look, if he was going to analyze this case as to whether there was an injury that was personal and concrete, he thinks it's debatable, and you could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that footnote is located.
Mm-hmm.
If you go on 2 pages later, he says, because it is fairly debatable whether Appellee's injury is sufficiently personal.
But No. Well, look, I'm not going to waste all my time arguing about where the footnote is placed, but it's also placed right after a case discussion, finding that there was standing in Coleman versus Miller. So I think we could spend lots of time debating that, but I think we definitely have to grapple with that there's certainly...
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, and look, it's only a concurrence, so you can take with it what you want. But
you're the ones that argue. You had relied on it.
That's right.
That's why I brought it up.
Point about it is this: Here's the sentence. Because it is fairly debatable whether appellee's injury is sufficiently personal and concrete to give them standing, it behooves us to resolve the question under more general separation of powers principles underlying our standing requirements.
Okay. All right. And you don't think that footnote is a qualification on those general observations?
No, because it's two pages before, and it's during his discussion about why the case was
lost today. Okay. All right. Another question for you. Could the House come to court to enforce a subpoena dispute against someone who is undisputably a private individual?
So the broadest formulation of our argument would be no. We don't think that Congress has any...
Your position is no. I know that you... I'm not getting into the argument here about how we should look at Mr. McGann. I'm just trying to make clear that you think the House can never come to court to enforce a subpoena, full stop.
Right. We don't think
government's position.
Injury that Congress has an injury in that context. Historically, as the Supreme Court made clear in the Reid decision in 1928, Congress's power to issue a subpoena differs widely from its power to sue to enforce it. The power to sue to enforce the law is vested in the executive, not in the legislature. But this court doesn't need to reach that broader proposition here because we do think that it's even clearer when they're suing an executive branch official rather than a private party.
Okay. And then let's say a former presidential advisor leaves the post, a close presidential advisor, very close, and then goes to serve as House General Counsel or in some role in the legislative branch, and there's a hearing, and that person agrees to testify before the House committee. Can the president come to court and sue the committee to block the testimony on privilege grounds?
So we certainly don't think that the president qua executive can, because that in any sort of the president as the president doesn't have an institutional injury for all the reasons we've argued about. There'd be a different question about whether the United States could bring a lawsuit, like the suit in United States versus AT&T.
And the executive branch versus legislative branch there.
Okay.
That kind of the lawsuits can be brought to court as long as the executive branch is the plaintiff.
Well, there's a fundamental difference between saying that the executive branch is the plaintiff and saying that the United States, as sovereign, is the plaintiff, and it is represented by the branch of the government that represents...
The interest of the what the Justice Department would be arguing would be the interest of the presidency, the office of the presidency.
It's part of the interest of the United States as a whole. The Constitution vests the power to litigate public rights in the executive.
I'm sorry. Were you finished?
Yes.
I'm sorry. If I cut you off, I didn't mean to cut you off. Okay. Now, Congress has its own contempt power, which I think you've referenced and the Supreme Court has recognized. And let's say, and you said, you know, that it's been rejected a few times, but let's say they were to arrest Mr. McGann and imprison him in the Capitol, and he, in light of the precedent you cited, files a habeas corpus action. I assume a court could entertain that action.
Yes, as I discussed earlier, we don't dispute that Mr. McGann would have a personal interest in his liberty, just like the congressman in Powell had a personal interest in his salary. So that would give him Article III standing, and he would be able to bring a claim, and we think the claim that he would prevail on is that Congress doesn't have the authority to arrest an executive branch official, period, full stop.
Okay, so he's personal for purposes of his liberty, even if his liberty is tied entirely to whether he testifies or not?
Right, just like in Powell, the congressman's salary was tied entirely to the fact that he was a congressman. The question is, there's a difference between what your interest is for your injury in fact and what your legal claim is on the merits.
Right. See, on another question, too, because you've talked here about, understandably, the Supreme Court said it many times, that Article III standing enforces the separation of powers. It's one mechanism of enforcing the separation of powers, in particular, vis-a-vis the role of the court. If enforcing a ban of standing would change the balance of separation of powers, would that be a ground for not adopting the position?
I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding what you mean by that.
You're saying that when Article III standing needs to be interpreted to enforce the separation of powers, not unsettle it. I guess you would agree with that proposition?
Yeah, I certainly agree that Article III standing is informed by history and tradition. So
no, that's not the question I asked. I asked if the Article III standing principles enforce the separation of powers.
Right, they do enforce the separation of powers.
If a particular interpretation would change the balance of powers, that would be certainly raise a large question mark about a propounded view of standing.
I guess my point is that the premise of your question is a little bit circular in the sense that
you may think it's circular or not. I'm just trying to make the point. I assume you would agree. I think it's your whole argument here that, in your view, enforcing the separation of powers here is necessary to maintain. Your standing position here is meant to enforce the balance in the separation of powers.
It is. That's right. And the reason why is because these sort of disputes have traditionally been left to the political branch to deal with them by themselves. And that is the balance and the separation of powers that has historically existed. The reason why that is the case for Article III standing purposes is that Article III standing looks to history and tradition. So the suggestion that you're making, where an Article III standing holding could disrupt the separation of powers, can't happen, because the separation of powers and the Article III standing reflect that history and tradition. They reflect the separation of powers.
Got it. Thank you. I'm sorry, and I don't mean to come up short, but I think I'm cutting into the time of my colleagues. So thank you very much for your answers.
Thank you. Judge Pillar?
Hi, Mr. Mouban. This is Judge Pillard. Your position acknowledges the undisputed authority of the House to issue a subpoena to a member of the executive branch. Am I right?
In general, to the executive branch, yes, we're not disputing that.
And then, I mean, the question is about enforcement mechanisms, and there's a lot of thinking about, you know, whether the House could go to court or not. And the classic line, it seems, between those who think that that the courts are open to the House and those who think the courts aren't, is among those who think the courts are not open, among Congress's political tools is inherent contempt arrest power on Congress's part. But I read your brief to say no, that Congress would lack in this setting that inherent contempt power to arrest. Am I reading you correctly?
That's in this setting. We don't dispute, as the Supreme Court has recognized in Anderson versus Dunn, that the Congress in general has inherent contempt authority, because that is the power that legislatures had long had at the time of the founding and was implemented by Congress immediately after the founding and was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1820. None of that is true as applied to executive branch officials. There is no history of Congress ever doing it. The Supreme Court has never upheld it. There's no need to do it because they have political tools that they can use against the executive branch, unlike private parties where they can't just pass laws, bills of attainder, against individual private parties. So the inherent attempt for private parties apply to executive branch officials.
That's what I understood to be the position in your brief, and there's just a little bit of ambiguity because you also quote a passage of the panel opinion. I think it's at page 20 of your brief, and you talk about the panel's point that Congress or one of its chambers may hold officers in contempt, withhold appropriations, refuse to confirm the president's nominees, harness public opinion, delay or derail the president's legislative agenda, or impeach recalcitrant officers. So you're not meaning to approve the panel's reference to holding officers in contempt, or you would say, yes, they can hold them in contempt, but they can't arrest them? I take you're quoting the panel there, so I'm just trying to understand. It seemed that you were affirming that position, and I'm just trying to understand which powers you think.
Yeah, no, thanks. I appreciate it. I think you're right that was slightly imprecise in that we don't think that it is contempt for an executive branch official to not comply with a legislative subpoena where a valid executive branch defense has been asserted. So I think you're right. That was imprecise on our part.
And you say where a valid executive branch defense has been asserted, here you mean the absolute immunity, because there hasn't been an executive privilege formally asserted here. Am I right?
You're correct about both. That there has not been, but there has been a direction to not testify based on the absolute immunity. But the reason I made the point about the executive branch objection is that it would be contempt, for example, if an executive branch official was subject to a subpoena, everyone agreed it was enforceable, and they just didn't comply. But that's not the circumstance we have here. We have a circumstance where the executive branch has made a determination consistent with the longstanding position of the Department of Justice going back 50 years that this is not a proper subpoena.
Okay, and when you said there, if everyone agrees it was enforceable, you mean if everyone agrees it was valid?
Yes.
Yeah. And okay, that's where I thought you were. And I mean, as I take it, the basic insight of the separation of powers argument against standing here that you're making for interbranch disputes is that the branches should use their political powers. The premise is each branch's political power is sort of, it's a reflection, it's appropriately calibrated to the interests of the public in having the respective branches act or maybe not act, be defeated in acting in whatever the pertinent ways are. So given their respective stocks of political capital, they'll fight for what's important and they'll let go of what isn't. Is that generally the gist of it? And that's
half of it. That's how they're supposed to deal with it. The first half and the more important part is that's how they've always dealt with it. They've never resorted to court.
Right, but that's based on history. I get that. So there's a historical record, and you're right that there's a fight to be had there. But I'm just thinking about this theoretical point about what are the separation of powers in areas where maybe the historical record is thin and people have arguments on both sides and, you know, those can be assessed. But I'm just struggling to see how that theory applies in the context in the McGahn case where the House has a well-established and undisputed ability to collect information, including collect information from the executive in fulfilling its core legislative functions. And it's my question for you is that when we evaluate what the alternative remedies, the political remedies are that are available to the House, does it matter at all how proportionate and practicable those available political remedies are and whether sort of leaving the House to resort to those remedies is actually protective of the separation of powers or destructive of the separation of powers?
Look, Your Honor, I think that Congress is able to make its own judgments about whether the tools that it has are worth deploying in order to enforce or to achieve compliance with an individual subpoena, and it can make those judgments for itself. I don't think it would be right for this court to try to make its own judgment that, you know, the cost isn't worth the benefit. Just like in cases like Campbell versus Clinton and Chenoweth, there too, one could have reasonably debated whether what tools Congress had, whether it was reasonable for, let's say in Campbell, where the plaintiff's entire legal claim was that they had defeated an authorization for war, they had defeated an authorization to use armed hostilities, and that they did not need to prohibit the president from engaging in hostilities because he needed affirmative authority. Nevertheless,
the tools here, but if you were, I just want to focus on this case. If you, I'm out of my time, but if you were a member of the House or if you were, you know, running the House committee and you're saying, we really do care about this, what would the political tool be that you would turn to?
So the most obvious things for the House to do are to stop either supporting either legislation or appropriations in a targeted way that focus on the president's legislative priorities. Obviously, if they can convince the Senate, they can then pass affirmative legislation in the same regards. If they had the Senate, they could also stifle nominations. And all that stuff can be done either in a targeted way or a more general way, depending on how strongly they care and about what those are the sort of political judgment calls that Congress should be making. But no one has ever thought that if those tools just aren't good enough, what they should do is instead just file a lawsuit. And I think the easiest way to think about that is imagine all the other things that the executive branch does that Congress might think is deleterious to what Congress has wanted to do. So imagine, for example, Congress passes federal statutes that criminalize various things, and the executive branch just isn't bringing enough prosecutions.
Congress can do all sorts of things to try to induce the executive to bring those prosecutions, and you can have a nice debate about whether...
I have to save time, but the question is, like, does it actually support the separation balance of powers to leave the House to these sort of huge, blunt, disproportionate political nuclear options when what it is the basic underlying information that everybody understands the House is entitled to? But I have to give up my time.
Okay. I could just one last thing, though, in response to that, which is just no one would that the legislature could bring criminal prosecutions if they're unhappy that the executive branch isn't bringing prosecutions it should be bringing. That is
right. That's why I'm saying I think the information context is different, but I don't have time to. I haven't been efficient in the way I've questioned you about it. So
I'll be sure to turn to that later, then, Your Honor.
Thank you. Judge Wilkins?
Yes. I want to talk to you about the structural protections in the Constitution. The Supreme Court has described those as being essential to protect individual liberty. I take it you agree with that?
Yes.
And the Supreme Court has also described structural protections as non-waivable. I think they've said that in INS v. Chadha, but they've said it in other cases as well. Do you agree with that?
In general, yes.
So, that being the case, why is it that there would be a requirement for both chambers of Congress to bring a lawsuit to enforce a structural protection? The other chamber can't waive that structural protection, so why do you need both?
Because there's a fundamental difference between the merits of a claim and who has standing to sue over that claim. Right? The questions you asked me about whether it's waivable or not goes to whether there's a violation of the law. But not every violation of the law can be sued over by any person. You have to have a party who has an injury that is cognizable. And what Bethune-Hill says is that if legislators could sue at all, both Raines and Arizona and Bethune all recognize that states and federals might be different on this axis.
Then how do you explain INS v. Chadha? I mean, it didn't matter with respect to the merits whether there was waiver. I mean, that was the whole point of the Supreme Court decision.
Well, so in INS versus Chadha, the suit in district court was brought by Chadha, a private party who clearly had Article III standing to complain.
Yes, but the court said that Congress couldn't waive the structural protection as they had by passing the law at issue that was challenged.
Right, that's the merits point. The point is that once there is a plaintiff with Article III injury to sue over the law, the fact that some branch of government was okay with the violation of a structural provision is not a merits defense. Here we're dealing with the threshold question of who is a proper plaintiff to sue. And there, what Bethune-Hill instructs us is that you have to make sure that the institutional plaintiff has an institutional injury. I guess in another way...
Where are you getting this distinction between waiver being effective as a defense to the merits but not being effective with respect to, or being effective as a defense to standing?
Where are you getting that? So from Bethune-Hill, but I think the key point is I'm not making a waiver argument. I'm making an injury argument. Bethune-Hill makes abundantly clear that there has to be a match between the institutional plaintiff and the institutional body who has the authority that is being invoked. That's the holding of Bethune-Hill. That's why the Virginia House by itself was not allowed to sue. It needed the Virginia Senate to come along. The reason why the court said that in Bethune-Hill is because the claim there was a claim to the Congress the Virginia legislature as a whole, and so half of the Virginia legislature couldn't sue. So too...
Do you agree that impeachment is a structural protection?
Yes.
Well, if the House has the sole power to impeach, then why does it need the Senate to come along to enforce that structural protection? why isn't the injury complete if the injury is to the house?
So in neither of these cases is there an asserted injury to the ability to impeach. They are asserting an injury in McGann about the subpoena. We're not making an argument in McGann that the House by itself is a problem. They need the Senate also. Where in McGann, our argument is that the House doesn't have an injury, period. The argument about the House versus the Senate is only an argument we're making in the Mnuchin case, where they are arguing about appropriations and spending.
All right. Moving on to the other aspect of structural protection, which is that they are intended to preserve individual liberty. Why isn't it appropriate for one or the other chambers of Congress or both chambers of Congress to prosecute a lawsuit because in doing so they are protecting and preserving individual liberty?
For the same reason you wouldn't let a law professor bring that lawsuit. The fact that the lawsuit preserves individual liberty doesn't mean that the plaintiff has an injury in fact. The Supreme Court has made clear time and again that in order to bring a lawsuit, the plaintiff has to be a proper party, and that requires an injury in fact of the type that has been recognized historically by tradition.
Well, with respect, sir, a law professor in the Chamber of Congress that the Constitution is specifically delegated this or given this structural protection to are in two entirely different things.
They are different things, but the point is neither of them has the type of injury in fact that has been traditionally recognized by courts. And the mere fact that the lawsuit vindicates a structural protection and individual liberty is not sufficient. So I'm not saying, of course, that Congress is no different from a law professor. What I'm saying is that it is not sufficient that the lawsuit vindicates separation of powers. You need to have a plaintiff who has the type of injury that the Supreme Court and this Court has recognized is judicially cognizable. And Congress or the House simply does not have that type of injury. And the reason why is because Congress and the House are institutions. They don't have personal injuries. They have official prerogatives that they hold on behalf of the public at large. And the entity...
If the Supreme Court meant to say that, why didn't they just say that in Raines and we wouldn't have this debate at all?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I think they basically did say that. Again, if you look at Raines has three basic section its opinion. They're not broken out by subsection, but they match the three sentences at the end that we discussed earlier. The first part of the opinion says the plaintiff is not asserting a personal injury. It's asserting only an institutional injury. That's true here. The second part of the opinion says we've only ever once allowed legislators, state legislatures, to assert an institutional injury, and it's in this narrow Coleman situation, and this isn't that type of situation. And the third section of the opinion says, history instead shows that these types of disputes between one or both houses of Congress and the executive have not been brought in court. It goes on for three pages about all of that, and then the conclusion, this isn't like some stray sentence, this is the conclusion of the opinion, is there would be nothing irrational about a system that allowed these suits, but it is obviously not the regime that is obtained under our Constitution to date. Our regime contemplates a more restricted role for Article III courts. It lies in the protection of individual citizens. It is not some amorphous general supervision of the operations of government. So I think the opinion is quite clear, and I think Justice Souter's concurrence is even more clear, that what they are saying is that federal legislators cannot sue over institutional harm.
My time is up. You've answered my question.
Thank you. Mr. Mupon, I just have a couple of quick questions. First, if we envision a scenario in which the role of the parties was reversed such that it were Mr. McGann who brought a suit against the House to a declaratory judgment action, perhaps coupled with a request for an injunction, to get a resolution of the validity of the assertion of privilege in response to the subpoena. your answer would be the same, that there would be no standing in that suit?
I think I'm actually not sure. I both the combination of the capacity of Mr. McGann to sue and whether Congress is subject to suit, I'm not sure, but I'm fairly skeptical that a suit would be permissible in those circumstances.
And skeptical, and I'm just asking about standing, in terms of standing. If we imagine that the suit got past the other issues and the suit were brought and could be brought apart from standing, your answer would be that suit can't go forward in court because of standing.
I think so. The reason I can't give you a definitive answer is, as we talked about in some of the earlier questions, a government official sort of has two different interests. They have their official interest and they have their personal interest. In a case
right,
where...
I'm assuming that he's asserting the same privileges that are at issue here. So in the can of privileges, it wouldn't be a personal privilege. It would be a privilege that protects an institutional, that's asserted to protect an institutional prerogative.
Right. So I think that's right. Then if all he was trying to do was assert the governmental prerogative of not testifying, and he wasn't trying to protect his own, you know, personal liberty or property or anything like that, then yes, we think that that would be an interbranch suit of the type that couldn't be brought, at least by Mr. McGann.
And then if we shift to the habeas hypothetical, you have a situation in which the House, let's say, asserts an inherent power of contempt and takes somebody into custody, and then there's a habeas petition that's brought. There would be standing for that.
Right, because then he is asserting his own personal interest in freedom of liberty, right?
And if there is suit, there is standing to bring that in terms of the personal liberty to be free of detention, but the legal issue that would be ultimately resolved in that would be the same, which is the validity of the assertion of the privilege?
Well, again, only if the threshold argument was rejected that they can't arrest an executive branch official.
So let's suppose that, I know that you have that position, but let's just suppose that the court doesn't agree, and the House obviously doesn't agree, and then let's suppose the court doesn't agree and gets past that.
Yes, then at that point, the merits claim would be the same merits claim that is in this suit. Just like in Clinton versus New York, the validity of the line item veto was, of course, adjudicated once it was applied in a way where, once there was a private party dispute where the validity of the statute was relevant.
Right, but here you'd have the same parties, and it would be the same legal issue that was ultimately addressed in the habeas situation.
That's true, but again, I guess my point is it would happen in the habeas situation because you had a private party whose rights and interests were implicated by that legal question. Here, you do not. You have a plaintiff who has no private interest in the enforcement of the subpoena. You have purely a congressional entity whose only interests are institutional and official, and that's the type of interest that does not make someone a proper plaintiff. And again, we are talking...
So it just seems... If you could just speak to this briefly, and then I'm done, and we'll get to follow-up questioning. It just seems a little bit odd that we would create a regime in which, in order to protect the separation of powers, the incentive, the impulse would be to go down a road that would create a greater separation of powers conflagration in the form of a detention of an executive branch official. Not saying that's realistic, not saying that anybody's suggesting that's on the horizon, but in terms of the implications for doctrine, that's where we'd wind up, and we'd have resolution of the same issue at the end of the day.
Well, so I guess I would say two things about that. One is we're talking about Article III standing, so I don't think it should be any surprise that who the plaintiff is matters. And so even if your consequence was true, I don't think it should change the analysis. Like, who the plaintiff is of fundamental importance to Article III standing. But the second point is, I understand the judges might disagree with this position, but I think it's a false hypothetical because we don't think that Congress can arrest an executive branch official. And if a court makes it clear once, that would be the end of it. There would be no interest in going around trying to arrest people to manufacture lawsuits that would determine the validity of the subpoena.
Right. No, I take your point. I take your position on the merits. Thank you. We'll proceed to any follow-up questioning my colleagues might have. Start with Judge Henderson.
Thank you. I don't have any questions.
Thank you. Judge Rogers?
Good morning, Mr. Lupin. I'd like to follow up on a couple of things my colleagues were exploring with you. Generally, when we're talking about Article III standing, do you not agree that the allegations by the plaintiff are to be taken through?
We agree with that, yes.
So, in response to Judge Wilson's question about the McGann case, you said there was no claim that the House had the inability to impeach. In that case, however, did we not have the extraordinary circumstance where we had the independent counsel's report following the Department of Justice's position that a sitting president could not be sued, that there were certain questions that the special counsel deferred to the impeachment process so that the House had information based on a multi-year study that there were things it wanted to explore. So the fact that the House could impeach, let's say hypothetically on ground one, but could not impeach without that information on ground two, you see no harm there to the constitutional responsibility of the House to investigate, get all the facts, and, well, I'll say I will limit it, all the material relevant facts, in order to make a considered decision about, A, whether to impeach, and, B, whether to impeach on which counts. So I'm unclear why, in that context, more had to be identified in terms of an immediate injury to the House's ability to responsibly carry out its constitutional duty of impeachment.
So let me clarify, and I think this will actually help me answer also some of Judge Pillar's questions and, as you say, Judge Wilkinson's questions. There is a difference between the House's ability to vote for impeachment and the House's ability to get information that it finds useful to engage in an impeachment inquiry. My point to Judge Wilkins is that no one was asserting that there had been the sort of vote nullification with respect to the ability to actually cast an impeachment vote. Your point, which is certainly what the argument that the plaintiffs are making, is that they are being deprived of information that they would find useful in casting a vote on whether or not to impeach. And my response to that, and this is also my response to Judge Pillard, is the fact that information is the fact that an injury would be concrete for an individual doesn't mean that it's concrete for government officials. So, for example, in Raines, vote dilution, we all know, is a cognizable injury when it's asserted by a private party. That's every Voting Rights Act case and one person, one vote case that's ever been decided has been decided based on a vote dilution injury. So, too, the inability to fire a subordinate is clearly a Article III injury if asserted by a private executive, but it's not an Article III injury if asserted by the chief executive if he tried to sue Congress over the Tenure of Office Act. The critical point to realize, and this comes directly out of Raines, is to recognize that government officials, they hold their office as trustees for the public. They're not themselves suffering concrete injury when they can't exercise their power. We know this from Raines, that if you dilute the congressman's ability to actually vote,
if that's not a concrete injury, then impairing their ability to cast an informed vote is even more attenuated and abstract. Congress doesn't even have a right to information. Their right to information is not expressed in the Constitution. It's ancillary and implied because it's necessary to carry out their legislative functions. So if Raines tells us that diluting their actual vote isn't a cognizable injury, then diluting the information they need to cast that vote, a fortiori, isn't a cognizable injury. And all of this is confirmed by history and tradition, which even the House and a long line of cases besides Raines tell us that at a minimum you have to look at history and tradition to determine whether a given injury is sufficiently concrete. And what history and tradition tell us is that not giving information to Congress doesn't create a concrete injury for Congress. And the reason why is there's a big difference between Congress issuing subpoenas and suing to enforce them. Issuing subpoenas, that's the prerogative of Congress. Enforcing subpoenas and enforcing the laws, that's the prerogative of the president.
So Justice Souter, in his concurrence in Raines, which everyone likes to quote, he found, first of all, that there was great difficulty in applying the rule that an injury on which standing is predicated be personal, not official. So he went on to say he thought it behooved the court to resolve the matter under more general separation of powers principles underlying our standing requirement. And he said, you know, we've cautioned that we ought to wait and get a private individual. But he has a sentence in here that says the court should exercise restraint only as a last resort. So as I understand your Mnuchin argument, it is in part that, well, the House can just pass another Appropriation Act, or it can pass another statute restricting what the president can do with regard to a wall. But of course, to pass an act, the House would need the Senate. And just if the Senate doesn't want to go along, then where is the House left? Given that the language of the appropriation clause is quite different because it's a negative command as opposed to an affirmative command authorizing legislative power.
So I'll say a couple of things about that. As to Justice Souter and his Raines concurrence, I think the key point he made is when he went to the broader separation of powers point, the point he made was that suits involving only official interests lie far from the traditional common law cause of action that's at the conceptual core of the case or controversy requirement. That is equally true, and it doesn't turn on what other political remedies are there. His point is that the political process is how you resolve these, and maybe Congress has enough political tools and maybe it doesn't, but that doesn't mean that the court should just allow congressmen to sue instead. As to
but
your
about except as a last resort. That's what I'm trying to get you to focus on here.
Right, but the last resort language, that's a quote from Valley Forge. If you look at Valley Forge, they're talking about suits by private parties. And the further way to confirm that is if you look later in Justice Souter's opinion, he specifically points out that it's a well-recognized principle of Article III standing law that you don't diminish Article III standing requirements, even if that means that there will be no plaintiff that has standing. And that is for the reason that the court, the quote is, while the court has declined to lower standing requirements simply because no one would otherwise be able to litigate a claim. He cited Valley Forge, and he cited Schlesinger, and he cited Richardson. And if you read Richardson in particular, Richardson makes clear that the reason that's true
is if no one is injured, that is proof that this is something that's to be resolved in the political process, not the judicial process. Turning to the second half of your question about the Senate, I think that there's just no different than what the circumstances that were true in both Chenoweth and Campbell. In both Chenoweth and Campbell, the plaintiffs there said that they had...
And we're not bound by those or the analysis in those.
Well, you're not bound, but this court has long recognized that even when sitting en banc, it applies principles of stare decisis. That's the critical energy mass case that we cited in our panel brief, in our supplemental brief. And
yes,
you don't just blithely toss aside past circuit precedent. Both Chenoweth and Campbell are well-reasoned decisions that were written post-Raines. I'm hard-pressed to see any argument for why this court would overrule those decisions. The House certainly hasn't argued that those cases should be overruled. And if you look at those decisions, it is equally true there that in order to invoke the political remedies that the court suggested, they would have had to get both House and the Senate to, and the President to sign those laws. But nevertheless, the court said that those were the political remedies that the plaintiffs had to invoke, even though the plaintiff's entire legal theory was that they didn't need to do those political remedies because they had already stopped the President from doing the challenge practice by not authorizing it. So, for example, in Campbell, the entire fight in that case was over whether President Clinton could engage in bombing in Yugoslavia. And there had been a vote in Congress that refused to declare war, and there had been a vote in Congress that refused to authorize the hostilities. And the plaintiffs came into court and said he therefore can't do it. And this court said, pass a law that prohibits them from doing it. You could have made the same exact point that, well, that's not fair. We didn't have to get pass a law. He needs authorization, and now we need to get the Senate and all the rest. This court said, no, congressmen don't have the ability to file lawsuits just because the President is exceeding his asserted statutory authority. Congress's remedy, if the President exceeds his statutory authority, is to pass laws making clear he doesn't have statutory authority. And by the way, the last thing I'll say about this is if that's not true, this court will be revolutionized because there is nothing different about the Appropriations Clause than any other claim that the President has exceeded statutory authority. Indeed, Congress could pass a statute that says any time the President cannot spend a penny on any activity that exceeds his statutory authority. And that would mean that Congress could come in, or indeed a single House of Congress could come in and sue every time the President exceeded his statutory authority, which means every Chevron case, every APA case, all of it would be brought not by private parties who were injured by the rule. It would be brought by the opposition party in Congress. That exemplifies exactly Justice Souter's point that it would be a severe problem for both the separation of powers and the politicization of the judiciary. It's exactly why you don't let Congress sue and you wait for private parties who are actually harmed.
So certainly I take your point about what are the limits in terms that you've just described, sort of the floodgate argument. But are you not struck by the fact that in these two cases, what is at stake is the separation of powers and the balance of those powers, and that deciding not to find standing itself implicates those powers? And I gather you say, well, as the Supreme Court has pointed out, sometimes there's just no one who will have standing to sue. And therefore, as I understand it, the only options for the people, in your view, would be further futile efforts to accommodate in the McGahn case, where the House committee has repeatedly sought accommodation, and White House counsel wrote a letter making it very clear that the President's position was no one in the executive branch should comply with any of the House subpoenas in connection with impeachment. And as to the McGann case, that there was absolute immunity. So given that under the standing principles you're citing, I've yet to hear anyone identified who would have standing as a private individual. So that if in a hypothetical situation, the president in his first year of office redoes the separation of powers, as some of Judge Garland's hypotheticals were suggesting, there's nothing that can be done until the next presidential election other than revolution.
So let me address that in turn, and let me address it case by case. So let me start with the Mnuchin case. In the Mnuchin case, there is nothing – this case boils down to a simple statutory interpretation dispute. Everyone agrees that Congress only appropriated $1.375 billion for DHS to build a border wall. There's no fight about that. The entire fight is instead, does the Department of Defense have separate pre-existing statutory authority to transfer funds? And by the way, the GAO agrees with us and with them. I agree, but my point is when you say that this case is some sort of fundamental separation of powers case that's different from all other cases, no, it isn't. It's just a statutory interpretation.
Then just so we don't spend my time debating the merits.
I don't want to debate the merits. The point I want to make.
I'm suggesting that the merits are before us, and I'm not indicating my position on the merits. I'm simply focusing on the Article 3 question, given that you agree we are take the allegations of the plaintiff as true for purposes of determining whether there is Article 3 standing.
I agree, and my only point is their claim is nothing more and nothing less than we have misread a federal statute about the scope of our spending authority. That is not a more fundamental separation of powers question than the question in Campbell versus Clinton about whether the President Clinton could bomb Yugoslavia without statutory authority. It's just a statutory question and a constitutional question about the scope of the president's authority under existing statutes. There is no difference in principle at all between the claims in Mnuchin and the claims in any case where someone says that the president has exceeded his statutory authority. And as to the second piece of your question, there are definitely plaintiffs who would have Article III standing in the border wall case. In fact, there have been plaintiffs who have Article III standing. Now, some of them don't then satisfy the separate zone of interest requirement. That's not a constitutional requirement. That's a statutory requirement that's wholly within Congress's control. But ultimately, if it turns out that there is no plaintiff that has both Article III standing and falls within the zone of interest, then that I go back to the point that I made before, that Richardson tells us that that's because it's the type of dispute that is committed to the political branches. And again, that doesn't mean we resort to revolution, because Congress in the political branches has ample tools. They can cut funding, they can cut other statutes, they can pass clearer prohibitions, they can cut nominations. All of those tools are available. Whether they're worth the political judge cost, whether Congress has enough political power to do it, those are features of the separation of powers. They are not bugs. The point is each branch uses the tools that it has. It does not usurp the tools of others.
Thank you, Mr. Mupon. I just want to make sure that Judge Rogers has a chance to finish her follow-up questioning so we can get to the House's argument.
I'm fine, Chief Judge. Thank you, Mr. Mnuchin.
Thank you, Judge Rogers. Judge Tatel?
Yes, I just have a very quick question about your reliance on Buckley versus Vallejo, where the court held that congressionally appointed officials could not file suit to enforce a statute, a classic take care clause function, which seems to me to be very different from the situation we face here, where Congress is not exercising a take care function, but is suing to vindicate its own constitutional interests. Isn't that a very different situation?
I don't think so for the following reason, Your Honor, which is the Supreme Court's decision in Reed. This is the 1928 case that we have cited in the briefs, where the court specifically said that there is a wide difference between Congress's power to issue subpoenas and Congress's power to sue to enforce them. And what the court said in Reed, and it cites McGrain, which is the seminal case about Congress's authority over subpoenas, is that the established practice for enforcement of subpoenas was criminal contempt, which, of course, is enforced by the executive. That is part and parcel of the separation of powers. Yes, Congress has the ability to issue the subpoena, but it does not have the ability to bring lawsuits to enforce the subpoena. That is vested in the executive.
But that's not a Buckley versus Vallejo argument, is it?
Well, I think it's closely related to it, because the point is there is no history and tradition of enforcing subpoenas as such. The history and tradition is...
We're now repeating ourselves, and another question.
I guess my only point is that the way you enforce a subpoena is through a criminal prosecution, and that is a Buckley point.
Point is taken. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Judge Garland?
Yes, thank you. I have just a couple of questions on the McGann case and a follow-up of a question that Chief Kuchinova asked. What if McGann wanted to file a declaratory judgment action in which his only argument was, I'm just doing what the president said, that is, I'm asserting the absolute immunity claim. Your answer to that was he wouldn't have standing because he was asserting a governmental interest. Is that right?
That plus, I don't think there would be a controversy there. Given that the House can't sue him, I don't see why he would have any Article III injury in getting an advisory opinion from a federal district court as to whether the president was right about the immunity.
All right. Yes. So just imagine purely as a hypothetical that Mr. McGann is a lawyer and he does not want the taint on his reputation of a House vote that he's in contempt of Congress. That's a personal taint that he doesn't want. And he doesn't want it because he's going to be arguing only that the only reason he's not answering is because of some kind of quasi-executive or absolute immunity claim. Doesn't the claim of personal reputational injury, would that be enough?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I'm also not sure whether he'd be able to bring that. It seems like it's fairly speculative whether he would be at risk of a contempt finding by Congress.
Chris announced, what if the House announced, look, we've subpoenaed you, Mr. McGann, show up. Mr. McGann says no, and the Congress and the House begins a vote on contempt, subject to his appearing. So it's not speculative at all. It's often not speculative. If the House committee issues a subpoena and somebody doesn't show up, it's hardly speculative that they might vote for contempt.
Okay, and so I guess if you get past the imminence point along the way you just suggested, then the question would be whether a declaration of contempt by itself without any ability to enforce it would be the type of injury that would support Article III standing. That sort of intangible harm, whether that would count or not, you would have to address that the same way you address all other Article III standing questions. You'd have to look at whether under history and tradition that sort of reputational harm in the air would be sufficient to support Article III standing. I don't know the answer to that question. I haven't looked at the history and tradition that governs it, but that is how you would answer it. And the history and tradition here says that Congress can't sue.
Okay, let me ask just another question. Could an individual, I take it that with respect to the document subpoena, I understand you say it's still under some kind of accommodation, but I take it your position is that the House has no standing with respect to that either. Is that right?
Yes.
So could an individual member of the House simply file a FOIA suit for the same documents and have standing? Set aside the question of whether there's a FOIA exemption. That goes to the merits, not to the standing question.
Yes, if they filed a FOIA suit in their individual capacities as just a member of the public, then
yes.
They could.
FOIA has no requirement of any kind with respect to who can sue.
That's correct.
Right? That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Right. So if instead of bothering with this process, the House chairman of the committee simply filed a FOIA suit asking for the documents, you would not dispute that they had standing. Is that right?
That's correct, because as the Supreme Court has held in Aikens and other cases, if Congress creates a private right in information, a right of private parties, not based on their government office, just the right that any person on the street would have, then that is the type of injury that the court has held can support Article III standing. What cannot support Article III standing is a right that is not benefiting any private interest. It is benefiting only an official prerogative. Congress, unlike a private party, can't just ask for information because it's curious. If you look at all of the cases that govern congressional subpoenas, they are replete with statements about how it has to be for a legitimate legislative function. In fact, Watkins, if I recall correctly, says something along the lines of it would be indefensible.
Pause a second. I understand that, but that, again, is a merits question. Assume there is a legitimate legislative function here, which we have to assume for purposes of standing. Your position with respect to the House is still that it can't, that there's no standing, right?
Yes, but my point is that they are not asserting a personal interest. They are asserting only a legit institutional interest.
I understand. So if tomorrow they just filed individual FOIA suits for the same documents, there would be no standing argument at all?
There would be no standing argument. Of course, they'd lose on the merits because there are FOIA exemptions, but yes, there would be no standing argument because they'd be asserting rights as private people. They didn't have to be congressmen to file those suits. Anyone could file those lawsuits. But only congressmen can file a suit to enforce a subpoena, a legislative subpoena. That's why this is like Raines, not like Powell.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Judge Griffith? Judge Griffith?
Chief Judge Srinivasan, this is Judge Griffith. I have no questions.
Thank you. Judge Millett? Judge Millett?
Yes, thank you. I just have two quick questions. Getting back to Judge Garland's question about whether if this suit were had been brought by Mr. McGann to sort of quash the subpoena. What if he filed it instead of asserting the injury he asserted was analogous to an interpleader action? He said, I have this information in my head, and I've got this subpoena from Congress, and it says, turn it over, come in and testify and turn it over, and I've got this directive from the president that says, don't go and turn it over. It's privileged. It would be a serious error and problem for you to do it. And so it comes to court, much like Mazur's, and says, I've got the subpoena. I'm willing to comply with whoever the court tells me whose direction I should follow. Is there standing there?
We don't think so. As Your Honor may or may not be aware, that situation actually did happen last year with someone named Mr. Cooperman, and he filed that suit, and both the House and we argued it was not justiciable. So a rare instance of agreement with us in the House.
Okay. And isn't that the position Mazur took?
I don't believe Mazur's made an argument that Mazur's didn't file a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mazur's is the defendant.
Okay, so no one could come in for a declaratory judgment that says I'm subject to conflicting demands regarding this information that I have, and it's going to have consequences for me, immediate consequences for me one way or the other, and so I'd like a declaratory judgment as to my legal obligations?
Not in this circumstance, Your Honor, because the House
Maybe
has no...
Maybe this circumstance.
Because the House has no ability to go after them, and if they're complying with the president's directive, then the president
Okay, you're asking about whether they would have Article III standing to bring that lawsuit. You have a merits argument about whether the House could or not use its contempt power, but I don't want to get to that. I just want to say, could someone have standing to bring that suit in federal court?
So we would say no, and that was the position that both we and the House took.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then with respect to the FOIA question that was asked, does anything in FOIA require you to identify your status as requesting out information in a private or official capacity? Or can you just file a FOIA request?
I believe it's the latter, but what that means is that it's by definition in your personal capacity because you don't have to identify any capacity.
Okay, but a FOIA request that came in on the letterhead of the chair of a congressional committee would still have to be addressed.
Yes, but it has nothing to do with if you're a member of Congress.
Okay, that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Pillard?
Hi, I just have one question, Mr. Mupan, whether the department has any position on the suggestion by the panel that the House might somehow acquire standing by the enactment of a statute.
Well, so I have a couple thoughts about that. The panel at the court has recognized that Congress's actions are relevant to Article III standing and that Congress can sometimes create injuries that would not otherwise support standing. We don't think in this circumstance that the test in cases like Lujan and Spokio would be met, but more importantly for present purposes, since that's a hypothetical, I think what's quite important is that Congress has not passed a statute that would authorize the House to bring this suit, and indeed, we think that Congress has made clear that the House cannot bring this suit. This is the suite of subject matter jurisdiction and cause of action arguments that we raised in our panel brief. We think that those are very important arguments, and we think, frankly, that they are a way, if this court finds the Article III standing question difficult, a way to avoid that difficult constitutional question is to say that at a minimum, the House can't sue when Congress hasn't even authorized it to sue, and indeed when Congress has passed a statute allowing only the Senate to sue and only against private parties, to allow the House to instead come in and file a suit in contravention of that statute and its statutory limitations is at a minimum not something this court should allow.
There's not an affirmative version that you can imagine that you would support that fits within the speculation by the panel?
Lujan invalidated a private right, a citizen suit provision, we think this would be analogous to that because our basic point is that Congress doesn't have personal injuries. They're an institution that is served on behalf of the public. Letting Congress sue, even if Congress says Congress can sue, is a tantamount to allowing a citizen suit provision. The federal laws are enforced, including subpoenas, public rights, are enforced by the executive, not by the legislature.
All right. That's it for me.
Thank you. Judge Wilkins?
No questions for me.
Thank you. Mr. Bouvant, thanks for your argument. We'll give you a bit of time for rebuttal. We'll now hear from the House. Mr. Letter, I know you and Ms. Barbera are both prepared to answer questions, but I understand you'll handle the opening statement. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge. And you can hear me, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Douglas Letter, the General Counsel of the House of Representatives, and as you just noted with me today is Deputy General Counsel Megan Barbero. We'll both be presenting argument, as you said. We don't wish to limit the judges in any way on when they can ask questions, so just feel free to ask whatever questions you wish whenever you wish. There are a number of points that my friend and former boss, Mr. Mupon, made that we do look forward to addressing. As you noted, DOJ argues here that under Article 3 of the Constitution, Congress can never, under any circumstances, initiate litigation because litigation is assertedly solely an executive function. We think that's wrong. Alternatively, DOJ contends that Congress can certainly never sue the executive branch in court. DOJ takes this absolutist position, even if the president, as we allege here, is violating the Constitution by disregarding Congress's authority in a way that directly threatens the central constitutional doctrine of checks and balances. And they take this position even as the administration announces that it will build the southern border wall, quote, with or without Congress, end quote, and that the president announced that he's fighting all subpoenas from Congress. In response, we emphasize that nothing in the text of the Constitution or in its development compels DOJ's view. By contrast, and something I'm going to mention in a moment, the Constitution does provide that neither the executive nor anybody else can sue Congress about its legislative activities. That's a very important contrast in the Constitution. So what would cause this court to use its inherent authority to define the boundaries of Article 3 of the Constitution by closing the courtroom doors absolutely to the House, which most directly represents the people of the United States, and to do so where the House is trying to preserve two aspects of our constitutional scheme that help prevent the executive from becoming a monarch? There's no valid justification for doing so here. These cases are narrow, and if the court rules in favor of the House, there should be little need for future suits like these. And there should be no legitimate floodgates here. Litigation is, as a practical matter, normally the worst option. Bargaining, conciliation, and compromise between the branches will nearly always be the preferred course. Various suggestions have been made about alternative means the House assertively has to protect its constitutional prerogatives, but as we hope to explain today, these alternatives are not practical and, especially with this administration, have simply failed to work. By contrast, litigation has proven to be a tried and true mechanism by which the courts have resolved constitutional disputes between Congress and the President on many occasions. There is no good reason to abandon it here. Ms. Barbero and I are now quite happy to take the court's questions and to address the points made by Mr. Mupon.
Thank you, Mr. Letter. Judge Henderson?
All right. Thank you. I prefer to listen to Mr. Letter's argument, so I have no questions.
Thank you. Judge Rogers? Judge Rogers?
Thank you. On the basic interpretation of Raines, what is your best argument in terms of the obligation of the court in determining whether there is Article III standing to look at historical practice?
Your Honor, on that, several responses. And I'm going to start off, by the way, by just taking a side trip for a moment. Mr. Mupon said that Raines requires that you look at the traditional role of the courts, and that nobody could think that that this kind of suit could be cognizable. Well, for 50 years, this court has said that they are cognizable, and the Supreme Court has never, not once, said otherwise or said that this court is wrong. So we think that Raines makes clear that history alone is not dispositive Otherwise, it could not have and would not have reserved the questions at the end of the opinion, which it did. So even though Raines itself made clear there was no history for such suits. Second, DOJ misunderstands why Raines resorted to history in the first place, Your Honor. Raines looked to history not as an independent element of standing, but merely to test its assessment that the plaintiff's claimed injury, the abstract dilution of institutional legislative power, did not satisfy the traditional three standing elements. So no similar history, resort to history, is necessary here because the committee's injury does have a long historical pedigree, especially in the informational standing situation. So the key here is this court has defined what makes Article III standing. We meet those standards. And then the Supreme Court merely then went on in Raines to look at history. I do want to emphasize, you know, Mr. Mupon said the court went on at great length, several pages, about history. If you look, virtually all of that history that the court discusses is about presidents not suing Congress. It's very interesting, but it's irrelevant here. We're not talking about, this is not a suit about the president suing Congress. At one point, almost at the end of that discussion, the Raines court says, we note that no member sued President Coolidge. Well, again, no member. And the reason I think that the court said that was because Raines was a suit about members. It was not a suit about congressional institutions, which is also the same about Chenoweth and Campbell. And Judge Rogers, if I might just take one more moment, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about the history and could, you know, Mr. McGahn sue Congress, could presidents have sued Congress, et cetera. Mr. Mupon didn't. He mentioned that we agreed at one point. There's a very simple reason why there is no history of this. But as I said before, the framers specifically put in the Constitution that you cannot sue Congress for its legislative activities. And so, of course, there's no history of that. And, of course, Mr. McGahn can't do that. But, again, as I said before, there is no such parallel provision in the Constitution. It is left to this court and ultimately the Supreme Court to decide what you think Article III can and should cover. I have other grounds why I think Raines is distinguishable, but I was trying to answer directly your question, Your Honor.
I appreciate that. If there's anything you'd like to say, I'd like to hear it. But the other thing I'm interested in is, what are the limits to a holding that the House has standing? The department is concerned about sort of the floodgates argument, that any time anybody doesn't like what the president is doing because it's not following, quote, the law, there could be a lawsuit brought by the House.
Yes, Your Honor, that's obviously a very key point here. It's something we've been discussing at great length because clearly it's something that you as a court and judges need to be concerned about. The limiting principles, first of all, are inherent in what both your court and the Supreme Court have made clear. The injury must be concrete, we think, and I can go into detail later about why we meet this test. But so it could just be Congress says we think the president isn't following this particular law properly. There'd have to be a concrete injury to the institutional interests of, say, the House, which, again, you have here. In general, you know, some sort of statement that HUD is not properly following the law in interpreting Section 8, I don't think that – it's very difficult to argue that that is a concrete institutional injury for the House, unlike the fact that – The House is not getting the information that it needs, and, you know, unlike that, basically the Mr. Mupon and the President and the Justice Department are arguing, the Appropriations Clause should just be ignored. It should be read out of the Constitution because it's all just a question of, is the President violating statutes? That is, that so misunderstands an absolutely key part of our Constitution and why the framers put that provision in as a result of their knowledge of the experience of, you know, the Glorious Revolution in England, the need to limit a monarch from just spending freely. And that's why that provision is there. And again, the position of the Justice Department is you should just ignore that provision. Congress should just pass more statutes.
Well, I think the department's position is in part that the House has many political tools available to it. And if at first you don't succeed, try again. What's wrong with that approach?
Well, the main thing that's wrong with that approach is we know by experience that it has not worked. The panel majority said the first option is we can politely ask the administration for information. That has clearly not worked. We can issue subpoenas. We've issued numerous subpoenas, and they have a very large number of them have been ignored. If we can't enforce subpoenas, then they become really like a joke. We can refuse to, we can put people in contempt. We can use our inherent powers, and I do want to, at the appropriate time, get into that at length because I think Mr. Mupon was mischaracterizing case law on that. But surely nobody thinks that a good way to interpret and limit Article 3 is to say you can't sue, the House can't sue in court. Instead, go out and arrest people. Maybe we could have gun battles between the Sergeant at Arms and the Attorney General's security detail. Then you could say, well, what about, you can shut down the government. Well, President Trump tried that. He said he welcomed that opportunity, that he was glad that we had given him that opportunity. That was an absolute and total disaster for the country. And then you could say, well, impeachment. That's my main answer to that, has been there, done that. And one of the very, very key points that was made in the impeachment proceedings, I sat on the floor of the Senate for a very long number of hours, and I heard over and over again White House counsel, so not just the personal lawyers for the president, the government lawyers for the president, told the Senate that the subpoenas, the very many subpoenas issued by the House could be ignored because the House should have gone to court to enforce those subpoenas. Mr. Mupon cannot deny that. That is exactly over and over again what the President and his official government lawyers told the Senate of the United States. Go to court and enforce your subpoenas. And the President can ignore those subpoenas because you didn't.
One quick question in connection with the appropriations matter. The argument is that, I understand it in part, well, the political tools have been exhausted, so this is a last resort to come to court. But on the other hand, there are private lawsuits that have been filed to contest the president's building of the wall.
That is correct, Your Honor. We participated in those suits as amicus. In those suits, it's interesting because the Justice Department arguing is that none of the suits that have been brought should proceed, that all of them are not justiciable for different reasons. But in any event, just because maybe in certain circumstances private citizens could sue, and I think Judge Garland's questions in particular, hypothetically pointed out, there are going to be plenty of instances when nobody can sue, that just because some private members may be able to sue, that doesn't mean that the House shouldn't be able to sue. And we don't think that that's anywhere in the Constitution. And on that point, if I may just add one more thing, Mr. Mupon said that Article 3 means that only private individuals, cases only in which private individuals are bringing these suits can be resolved. That's absolutely not true. We have cases that the Supreme Court and this Court have resolved that are states versus states, federal government and states versus each other. We even have cases like United States versus ICC where the federal government is litigating against itself. So the courts routinely adjudicate cases that private individuals, not private individuals.
Well, thank you. I'll let my colleague proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Judge Tatel?
Mr. Letter, if the President started a war without a congressional declaration of war, could Congress sue him?
Your Honor, I think that's a very difficult question, and could Congress do? And by the way, I just want to point out, you've asked the question in a way that's very different from Mr. Mupon. Mr. Mupon was saying, you know, look at Chenoweth and Campbell. Those were suits by individual members.
Right, yes.
I think that there would be, first of all, a significant question of whether that would indeed be a political question, because it would involve foreign relations, war powers, et cetera, at its very core.
That's an interesting point, but set that aside for a minute. What about standing?
Okay. As I say, I think that would be a much more difficult case than either of these two, and the court could say that would be a very difficult case. Here, all we're talking about are, in one case, the informational interests of the House, and I have a lot more I could say about that. And second is we have the Appropriations Clause is a prohibition on the executive. It's an affirmative prohibition. There are very few provisions like it in the Constitution.
I understand that, but setting aside the language of it, in both cases, my hypothetical and this case, the President can't act. In the Muchin case, he can't spend money. And in my hypothetical, he can't go to war without congressional declaration. So in both cases, the President is under the Constitution prohibited from acting without congressional approval. So they don't seem to me to be different.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the constitutional provision about going to war, I don't believe that it is framed in the same way that the Appropriations Clause is.
So that's
why I set aside
the technical language. Of course it isn't, but it does say Congress has the power to declare war, and that's understood to mean that the President can't go to war without a declaration. And what I'm asking you is, can you explain to me, other than the language of the two provisions, why as a practical matter it's any different in terms of result? In neither case can the President act without congressional approval, a declaration of war in one case and an appropriation in the other.
Right. And, Your Honor, I think the wording is the key, because notice there are a number of provisions in the Constitution that say what Congress can do or can't do. This provision, the Appropriations Clause, makes clear that it is a prohibition on executive action. And so I think this is a situation where it is possible that the framing of the constitutional text could make a difference. And I just don't feel able to answer your question with a definitive yes, no, but I do think this is a question where the formal language of the Constitution makes the Appropriations Clause different from almost every other one in the Constitution. And so I think this case...
And I understand your position, and I have no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Garland? Judge Garland?
Yes, thank you. I just want to follow up some on Judge questions, which I think get to the question of how you propose to narrow. You said during your opening that this could be a very narrow decision. I'm particularly talking about the Mnuchin case. You were unwilling to say yes or no to Judge Tatel with respect to the war power. What about legislation?
As for regular legislation, Your Honor, I think that it would be much, much more problematic for Congress to have the ability to sue. Because that definitely would raise very seriously the floodgates problem.
Is your answer no standing under those circumstances, or just that it's a case?
I would think that in almost every situation there would be no standing. It is possible. I don't want to close the door entirely. It's possible that we can come up with some very strange case where Congress would have the authority, but I do think you could write a narrow opinion that says it would be very constitutionally problematic to expand it as to appropriate the Appropriations Clause because of its very special nature, that we can feel much more comfortable in saying that there's no reason to interpret Article 3 to say that the House cannot sue under the very odd circumstances of that statute.
What is it that makes, other than the wording of the Appropriations Clause, what is it that makes it special?
It's the wording is the key thing, and its impact. And what it means is it has to have some special impact, because otherwise, why did the framers bother to put it in the Constitution at all? DOJ has said, well, except for his inherent authority, the president can't act except as authorized by Congress. Well, that is true, and therefore, we need statutes to be passed for agencies to be able to act. But the Appropriations Clause is a specific power given to each chamber individually as a check on executive spending. And again, its language and its history shows why it was put in the Constitution. And the DOJ position reads it out of the Constitution. There is no need for this provision if DOJ is right, that it is just the same as the president can't act without authority from statutes. It's not just like any other statute that Congress passes and the president either follows or doesn't follow.
Well, again, to follow up on this, you made the point in your opening that the founders knew the importance of stopping a monarch from spending freely. I assume the founders also knew the importance of a chief executive not legislating by executive orders. Is that right?
Yes, certainly, although, yes, I'm not sure.
So would you also give up standing on the behalf of the Congress to challenge a presidential executive order, which is outside of the president's inherent authority and which the House and Senate believe could only be done by legislation?
I am giving that up, Your Honor, because, again, what would be – you'd have to come up with a situation where an executive order wasn't in any kind of inherent power of the president, and caused concrete injury to the house as an institution. And I think it would be very difficult
to
come up with.
Let's shoot at you with the same hypothetical I gave to Mr. Upan. The president asks for a health care insurance bill. House and Senate refuse. The president then announces, well, I'm going to do this on my own.
Right. And so, Your Honor, if we have a situation where the president says, I don't have any authority to do this, I asked for it, Congress said no, I shut down the government for a long time to force the Congress to agree, they didn't, so now I'm just doing it on my own, and I'm spending money. That would, I believe, be something that the House gets you about.
There must be any number of pieces of legislation that don't require the president to spend money. Not exactly sure what question to ask in that regard now, but imagine that the president wants a certain kind of power to do a certain kind of thing, I don't know, related to immigration or any other number of things that you could think of, but doesn't require spending money. President asks for the approval of Congress. Congress refuses to give it. President does it anyway. Is your position that the Congress does not have standing in those circumstances?
For the reason I said before, I don't wish to give a definitive never answer, but it would be very difficult to think of, one, how there would be any institutional injury to the House that would support such a suit in that instance. And again, you'd have to be so worried about the floodgates problem. So I would think that either never or virtually never could the House bring a suit in that type of situation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Letter. My time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Judge Griffith?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Letter, I don't think I'll ask you about the McGann case. We've spent a lot of time on that, the two of us. So let me ask you some questions about the Mnuchin case. I don't understand your insistence that the presence of the appropriations clause here makes a difference. I think you've conceded that at the very least it would be unlikely that Congress would have standing to challenge a president who exceeded statutory authority in his actions, right? Why isn't that the case here, that the president has exceeded, the allegation is the president has exceeded his statutory authority in spending? And any case in which the president exceeds his statutory authority, why can't Congress make the claim that that's a violation of the bicameralism and presentment clauses and has therefore injured them? There's a text in the Constitution that protects them and their role in the lawmaking process, and when the president exceeds his statutory authority, he's disregarded that. Why wouldn't that be the case?
Let me first say, Judge Griffith, I'm disappointed that you're not going to ask me about McGann. I was looking forward to talking with you about that further. I think we only got to talk about it for an hour or two before. Because the Appropriations Clause is different, it is a it says right, it's in there, you know, that it's saying the president cannot spend money. It's a prohibition.
But the bicameralism and presentment clauses say that law is created by bicameralism and presentment. If the president avoids that and makes law, why isn't that the same sort of injury?
Because, again, I'm coming back to the specific wording, and I think we believe the framers had a very specific and different intent with regard to the Appropriations Clause as opposed to any other legislation.
So if I disagreed with you and thought that this case is really just about an allegation that the president has exceeded statutory authority, you don't think I could save your argument by saying it's a violation of the bicameralism and presentment clause?
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't see that.
Let me ask you quickly. My time's almost up. Why doesn't Bethune Hill bar your suit? Isn't it pretty clear from Bethune Hill that you need to have the Senate with you right now to bring this suit, if there was standing at all? But you don't. This is just the House trying to, in your argument, to protect the institutional interests in a process that's bicameral. You need to have the Senate here.
Your Honor, no, we don't. This case is fundamentally different because the plaintiff here, the House, is asserting its own institutional injury. In Bethune Hill, the Supreme Court's opinion makes clear there was a mismatch between the plaintiff and the injury. The asserted injury was to the Virginia General Assembly,
The interest here belongs to the whole Congress, right? Appropriations need to be made by law. House can't make law by itself. That's saying the institutional interest here belongs to the House and the Senate.
That's correct, Your Honor. We think here that under the Appropriations Clause, both the Senate and the House individually have an interest, an institutional interest, because the government cannot operate at all without appropriations. If the president proposes, a bill, the National Labor Relations Act, and one of the houses says we're not interested, the government doesn't stop. It just means a particular piece of legislation doesn't go forward. That's what bicameralism and presentment requires. But the government cannot operate at its most basic level without any appropriations, and the framers knew that. And therefore, that's why this provision is unique, and why it means that each chamber of Congress has its own individual power, because it has the ability to stop the government from operating. Whereas for everything else, yes, any statute would need both houses, but the government goes on. And there could be inherent powers, as Judge Garland was saying, there could be any number of inherent powers the president might or might not have. But if the president is going to spend money, there is no authority whatsoever to do that.
Okay, thank you. My time's up. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Judge Millett. Judge Millett.
Thank you. So, Mr. Leiter, you've been talking a lot about how I think the appropriations clause or its wording makes a big difference here. Can you just spell that out for me? What about its wording makes it different from, say, bicameralism requirements for legislation? Since, as Judge Griffith said, it requires appropriations by law.
Well, Your Honor, because it says no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. So it is a specific prohibition on anybody doing anything, anybody meaning any part of the government doing anything. There are almost no other provisions that do that, and certainly the few that exist are nowhere near.
For a title of nobility on somebody, they could also sue. Or if the president tried to get preference to certain courts?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because nobility, it's not something that goes to the very foundation of the government itself. Remember, as I said, the appropriation.
Okay, but textually it says no preference shall be given to shorten it to ports of any state. No title of nobility shall be granted, and in between those two is no money shall be drawn. So I'm trying to. I thought you just said it's the prohibition. So maybe it's not the prohibition. It's the prohibition plus.
It's a prohibition plus, because there on the nobility situation, I don't think the House as an institution could say that it has been injured as an institution because a president gives a title of nobility. But as we know, the government can't operate, and since both the House and the Senate each have power over appropriations, as we said and argued extensively, that's why we think that that does meet the concreteness requirement of Article 3.
Okay, and that clause goes on, the nobility clause goes on to have the, what's it called, the foreign emoluments clause, which does begin with no, and then also has without the consent of Congress. So right. You're putting that you know, suit by, I know we had a situation with a suit by some members of Congress, but if we had a suit by, that we said there was no standing, but if the House itself brought the Foreign Emoluments Clause claim with them?
Your Honor, that would certainly be different from the litigation that has been brought. It might very well be that the House could bring such a suit. That for all, the reason that I'm saying, I think that would be extremely problematic because it's hard to see how that would be an injury to the House anywhere near as foundational as the violation of the Appropriations Clause. That, again,
well, it's an injury in fact. It doesn't have to be like a really big injury in fact, as long as there's an injury in fact. I'm just trying to understand, well, is the rationale here textual, which you kept referencing, is it text plus history? Is it text plus history plus absence of any corollary power under Article 2? Like, you know, in war powers, you've got, the president has Article 2 powers that are relevant to that same subject. I'm just trying to figure out just have you spin out this theory a bit more.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm going to answer the question by saying yes. When you put it, it's the text plus the history, this grant of a very core power to each chamber, and therefore to the House, the history of, as I said, coming from the Glorious Revolution, the fact that it is so foundational. So, again, I guess I'm going to answer your question. Yes, it's a combination of these various factors put together that make the appropriations situation
in the absence of any power in Article 2 that could be said to compete or bump up against that power in Article 1, such as commander-in-chief, control over foreign policy, those types of things?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And so, you know, if the president says, I want to move the 3rd Division from, Germany to France, you could say, well, that's a commander-in-chief power. Now, that takes some money, but the way appropriations are normally set, the president could do that. But if the president says, I want to totally change the Section 8 housing program and double the amount of money, I can't see how that would possibly involve any inherent authority of the president of any kind.
Okay. And one more question. Mr. Mupin the Justice Department, and he here in court today, has argued, at length about the absence of historical precedent. At least at the Supreme Court level, we don't have anything exactly on point for something like McGann or Philly Mnuchin. We don't have a yes, we don't have a no. And Judge Henderson, in her concurrence in the McGann case, had looked at all that very carefully and just said, look, we don't have guidance, and we seem to have conflicting, at least I read Arizona State Legislature as, you look at one section and it points one way, you look at another, footnote somewhere else, it seems it could arguably point another way. And so if we feel like the guidance from the Supreme Court is, there's words there, but there's words going both directions. What do we do? Do we just say we can't give history any role here? I'm trying to figure out what we should do. How do we deal with that?
No, Your Honor. History can indeed be important. So let's break that down, though. So first of all, courts do have a tradition of ruling on, you know, subpoena cases and spending cases, et cetera. These are traditional things that the courts do rule on. Second, just a side point, very important side point I want to make. History, though, has its limitations. As we pointed out in our brief, Glass versus Cohen, the Supreme Court decided for the first time that it was going to recognize Article III standing under certain circumstances. So there was no history there. So certain times, history gets overridden. In addition, we do have to understand, as we pointed out in our supplemental brief, we think there is a very good explanation for why, until the last 50 years, there were not suits by Congress over information. Because as we pointed out, and
I think... That's an empirical explanation for why they aren't there. I'm giving you in my question that the history's not there. It's, you know, the absence of evidence is not ordinarily evidence. On the other hand, we have the absence of evidence, and then we have some Supreme Court discussions and cases that go in some point one direction, some seem to point another direction, even sometimes within the same opinion. And so this is, you know, this is a big, these cases, both of them are sort of big, they're big deals. And so how do we know what the right rule is?
They're
big deals either way, to be clear, either way, right? It seems like a decision either way may not be fairly described as neutral in these cases. So I'm trying to figure out.
Just a very quick answer on that, Your Honor. If the court goes with the Justice Department arguments, you will basically make an enormous change. Congressional oversight, as it has been known for this country for years, is going to change and be very, very different. Also,
right.
You do have a
separation of powers, certainly.
Right. You have a 50-year tradition in this court, this very court. So that's not to be sneezed at. That's 50 years that you have of this. The point is, I don't think it makes that it shifts the way that Congress and the Congress deal with each other, because for most of its history, it has been dealing with each other with lots of give and take and accommodations. The fact, one of the reasons there hasn't been so many suits before that 50-year period is because very often Congress would make requests but would give the president an out. And so the president would take that out, and so Congress wouldn't sue about it. Clearly, though, there are any number of situations where prior presidents would say, yes, you're entitled to this information, particularly in the impeachment context. And Mr. Mupon's, I have to say, the one thing that I was really surprised about Mr. Mupon's presentation is he was saying that the alternatives are Congress should impeach without necessary information and should pass statutes without necessary information. How can that possibly be the right answer? We need this information, otherwise Congress is passing statutes in a vacuum. And as we quoted, John Quincy Adams said quite clearly, it would be silly to say that when you can't get information under impeachment, which you impeach. That just cannot be the appropriate way to set up a government and to say, and therefore, Article 3 should be interpreted narrowly because you can always impeach. Well, you can't impeach if you can't get the information. And remember, McGahn, so much of McGahn is about impeachment. Mr. McGahn, would have been a very important witness.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. I think my time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Pillard.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Letter, on Mnuchin, I wonder if there's a tenable line that would support standing here without also deciding that standing would necessarily be available to challenge other appropriations violations. I don't see that you're making any sort of more modest claim that, for example, here there's really no arguable lawful basis for the claim of statutory authority to divert the funds. I did notice in your complaint you explained how the two of the different sources of funds, the emergency funds under 10 U.S.C. 2808A is only for military construction, and then the counter-drug measure in the 2019 Appropriations Act seems to prohibit use for military construction, but you don't make explicitly an argument that this is in sort of a subcategory of appropriations violations that are so patent.
Your Honor, one, we don't think there are good arguments in this situation. In a sense, it's like House v. Burwell, where the executive did have some ground that it said for why it could spend the money, but the judge there said, I think it was just Collier in that one, said, no, there isn't really any valid statutory argument. Here, we don't think it's so clearly against the statutory language, and one of the provisions that GAO did not opine on, trying to transfer money under 2808, that can only be done for military construction. Obviously, building a border wall is not military construction. That's just absolutely clear. And in fact, it's obvious that the president didn't think that this was a valid ground either, because why did he shut down the government for the longest time in our history and then agree to a legislative compromise and only then start doing this and moving money? There would have been no reason for him to do. He would have to shut down the government. That made no sense whatsoever. And surely the Justice Department isn't going to say, yeah, the president acted without any sense at all, but that's okay. These are clearly statutory arguments that are cobbled together that completely are inconsistent with the plain language of the statutory provisions. As the district court and the Ninth Circuit have concluded. So this case is, we think, an easy one for saying why the appropriations clause has been violated here and can be sued about. And again, there have been almost no appropriations clause battles over the years. This is definitely not a floodgates problem. This is not a situation where we're suddenly going to have a whole lot of cases about appropriations, because in plenty of instances, most often, we've talked to our people here in Congress, the staffers who actually do this stuff. They said it's exceedingly rare that it's a situation like this where the president is saying, his administration is saying, we're going to build the wall with or without Congress. It's instead very technical and difficult issues about, well, was this appropriated for this purpose? Could this be moved, et cetera? So there clearly is no floodgates practical problem here.
I really appreciate that information, but I thought you were saying you wouldn't make a distinction between this kind of clear, obvious violation and the typical appropriations violation. It just strikes me, I mean, you know this, having worked for so long in the Department of Justice, that appropriations and anti-deficiency, it's a notoriously Byzantine area of law, and if Congress wanted to get into critiquing how the executive branch used money, it would be a lot more complicated in a lot of other cases, but you're not making a claim for because this is so out of line, it's a case that would affect standing. The obviousness of this is, you know, and I mean, part of where I'm coming from is, you know, unlike the standing to enforce a subpoena, we don't have 50 years of our district and our circuit court cases assuming, and or holding that this is something that we're willing to adjudicate at the behest of House of Congress.
Your Honor is... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Your Honor is making a very good point. I think you can still write an opinion here that says, because of the extraordinary circumstances in this case, the shutdown, the clear denial, the fact that, as I say, statutes on their plain face don't authorize this, that this is one of those rare cases where Congress, the House does have an institutional, has shown that it has a concrete institutional injury. I think you could then say, as you just did, I think very eloquently, most appropriations disputes are going to involve Byzantine regulations, legislative practice, et cetera, and therefore it is extremely unlikely that there will be other appropriations cases that would be cognizable. If this becomes a problem, obviously the courts can then say, Article 3 is we do have a floodgates problem here, and therefore Article 3, that's one of the concerns about, legitimate concerns about Article 3, and so we are putting a stop to that. So I think there is a way for you to rule here in a very narrow way based on the specific facts of and background of this case and the statutes involved, without opening up that we're likely to get many, many more of these cases and the problems that might raise for relations between the branches.
Thank you, Mr. Letter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Wilkins.
Yes, Mr. Letter, if we were inclined to agree with you in either of these cases, why wouldn't it be appropriate for us to limit the institutional standing to those circumstances where there is both a recognized structural protection that has been injured by the institution that is seeking to have standing in our courts, and B, the equivalent of exhaustion of all political remedies? Why wouldn't that be a fair way of looking at this if we were inclined to agree with you?
That's very interesting, Your Honor. If I apologize if I might not be understanding fully. There might be a problem if you say there has to be exhaustion of remedies, the political remedies first, before we can allow a suit, because, one, as we have learned to our great sadness, exhausting those institutional remedies takes an extremely long time. The House only lasts 2 years, and so you would have, you'd have a major practical problem where if you waited to see whether there was any exhaustion, it would just take too long. Now, as we know, we do have to engage in accommodation, and this court's precedent says that, and we agree. And if I may just take a sidestep for one moment, we have complete disagreement. Mr. Mupan was making it sound like we could have more discussions and accommodation about the documents. We reached an agreement about the White House documents. The White House has to date produced not a single one of the documents because they were not then complying with the accommodation that we reached, and they started raising more conditions after we thought we had an agreement. And so there is nothing to talk about. There is no further accommodation of documents. Bottom line, we have received no documents. But the main point, Your Honor, to say is I'm worried about how that would work in practice. But again, please tell me if I'm misunderstanding your question.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is why isn't it appropriate to, I guess, graft into this some consideration of either, you know, accommodation or exhaustion, because we don't want to encourage a scenario, however we rule, whereby no one will try to cooperate because they can just go to court, and, or if we rule against you, you don't want to have a situation where no one will try to cooperate because the other side can't go to court. It seems like neither one of those alternatives is a good one.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor. I now fully understand your question. I apologize before. You make a good point. My response is, one, we do have to try to accommodate. That's already part of this circuit's law, and we agree. We have no problem with that. The problem is, as I said before, all litigating attorneys and all judges know that litigation is almost always the worst option, again, because of the timing. So if the executive, whoever happens to be the president at the time, knows that ultimately we can go to court, we should have much more success, as we had for almost 200 years of working with accommodation, conciliation, bargaining, et cetera. The president and the Congress over many decades have been able to work things out. As I say, that's why for so many years there weren't lawsuits, and one of the reasons why. And so I still think it's going to be extremely rare that we're going to get these kinds of suits, because if we get accommodation and bargaining, et cetera, and compromise, we in Congress will get some or much of the information that we need in order to legislate or impeach. Whereas if we have to go all through litigation, that's we're going to run out of time. So that litigation is in general not going to be a good option for the House.
Just one final follow-up. What accommodation, if any, has the House offered with respect to the testimonial aspect of the subpoena to Mr. McGann?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I need you to repeat that question because we're having a technological problem with the other phone here. And so could you please repeat that question for me? I'm sorry.
Yes. What accommodation, if any, has the House offered Mr. McGann with respect to the testimonial aspect of the subpoena?
Oh, Your Honor, we had, I was part of this, we had numerous discussions with White House counsel trying to come up with something whereby Mr. McGann could testify under certain circumstances. He could answer, he'd respond to certain types of questions, maybe not others. We went round and round with White House counsel, trying to think at least probably about four or five times discussions, maybe even more. But at a certain point, it became clear that the president's position was that Mr. McGann has absolute immunity, and therefore there won't be any testimony. We talked about, could there be first a deposition? Could there be interrogatories that he would answer, et cetera? But ultimately, the determination was that the president said there's absolute immunity. So there was nothing that we could negotiate to. And remember, if I may, Your Honor, we never said Mr. McGann has to answer all questions. This is absolute immunity. We said Mr. McGann needs to come in and testify. He or the president can claim, the president can claim executive privilege as to various questions or subjects. So, and then there would have been accommodation. We could have said, okay, we won't ask about that subject, but could we ask about this one? And we could have talked our way around a whole batch of things. This is a claim of absolute immunity, not simply executive privilege.
All right, thank you. That's my time.
Thank you. We'll ask each of my colleagues if they have a follow-up question. Judge Henderson?
Thank you. I don't.
Thank you. Judge Rogers?
I'll pass.
Thank you. Judge Tatel?
No, I have none.
Thank you. Judge Garland?
No, thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Judge Griffith?
No.
Thank you. Judge Millett?
No more questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Pillard?
That's also it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. And Judge Wilkins, right back to you.
So the pressure's on me to break the chain here. No further questions.
Judge Wilkins, is there's a tradition or a history of no further questions? Is that influencing you?
of course I follow tradition and history, indeed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Letter. We'll proceed and give each side a brief rebuttal, and we'll hear from you in just a moment. Mr. Mupon, we'll give you 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll start with Mnuchin. So I'm glad to hear Mr. Letter basically concede that virtually all statutory violation claims the House doesn't have standing, or even Congress, and the ability, his attempt to distinguish all other cases from spending cases just doesn't really hold up for two reasons. The wording of the Appropriations Clause can't possibly matter because that's the merits of whether there's a prohibition, and also the reason the Appropriations Clause exists is because absent it, there might have been an argument that the president had independent Article II authority to spend money to accomplish statutorily authorized projects. That's what the Appropriations Clause does. It takes off the table that independent Article II authority. But the second point is I heard no response from Mr. Letter to the hypothetical of what if Congress passes a statute that says you can't spend any money on anything that's not statutorily authorized. He admitted that there would be serious constitutional problems if they sued over that, but that statute would recreate all of them. All of that shows you that what spending isn't any different than statutory authority questions, and all of it is dealt with through political tools. That's how Congress deals with it, and here in particular, where there is not a clear and unambiguous violation, where even AL agrees with us, the way to solve this problem is through Congress's political tools. Turning to McGahn, on the question of history, I guess I'll say a couple. First point is we know that Raines gave significant weight to that, and we know that when Raines talked about history, it didn't talk about individual members of Congress. It talked about Congress as a whole. So to rule for the House, you'll have to say that that opinion, that part of the opinion, can't be given its full due. Conversely, though, nothing in either Raines or Arizona or any other case affirmatively suggests that all of Congress can sue as an institution. Arizona involved state legislature, not a federal legislature, and has a footnote expressly emphasizing the importance of the difference. So if you're going to give full weight to the Supreme Court's opinions, as you're required to do as a lower court, the right way to handle it is to say, even if there's not a square holding about what to do as the full Congress, we know that the Supreme Court has emphasized history and tradition. It has emphasized that even for Congress as a whole, and it has never backed away from that for Congress as opposed to for state legislatures. That is the proper approach for a lower federal court to do, and that's because history and tradition is what informs Article 3. The words case or controversy, they don't have dictionary definition meaning that you can apply here. You look to history and tradition to determine what is a case or controversy, what is an injury, and what we know is that these sort of institutional injuries are not cognizable in federal courts.
Thank you, Mr. Mupon. I want to make sure that my colleagues don't have any final questions of you. Thank you for your argument this morning. Mr. Letter, we'll give you 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Your Honor, this is Megan Barbero, Deputy General Counsel for the House. I hope that you're all able to hear me. We had a technical difficulty on our end, as Mr. Letter said.
Yes.
Your Honor, DOJ's argument today is one for total executive non-accountability, no matter how lawless its actions. And nothing in law or logic justifies that startling position. This is a government of laws, and what the law is does not depend on the political branch's ambition, as my friend said. I'd like to focus on three brief points in rebuttal. First, this is a case or controversy. The injuries suffered by the committee in McGahn and the House in Mnuchin support standing. In McGahn, when an executive official defies a committee subpoena, the committee suffers a familiar informational injury. Congress needs information. It is the lifeblood of Congress's exercise of its Article I powers. And every day, courts resolve subpoena disputes. This court did so in Senate Select Committee and in AT&T. And the courthouse door should not be uniquely closed to congressional plaintiffs after 50 years. The Department of Justice relies extensively on Reed. I'd just like to say that case has nothing to do with Article III standing. It's a question about the interpretation of a jurisdictional provision that has no bearing here, and the very short opinion bears that out. In Mnuchin, we have the rare case where the executive has violated the appropriations clause by deciding to spend billions more on border wall construction than Congress appropriated. Nothing about their statutory defenses changes the fact that this is a rare constitutional violation of the appropriations clause. The clause expressly prohibits the executive from spending without authorization by each House of Congress and gives each chamber an independent veto power over the executive. Because of those special features of the clause that Mr. Letter discussed at length, the House has suffered a cognizable injury. Second, the Department of Justice says Raines controls this case, but it ignores the express limits of that decision. As the Supreme Court explained in Arizona State Legislature, Raines held, quote, specifically and only that individual legislators lacked standing to challenge the constitutionality of a statute. That is not the type of challenge we have in either case here. And DOJ has oversold the importance of history to Raines. For 150 years, Congress had little need to sue, and over the past half century, when Congress has sued, the courts always decided those cases on the merits. Third and finally, on separation of powers, DOJ has it exactly backwards. Judicial resolutions of subpoena disputes and the rare case where the executive decides to spend money in violation of the Constitution safeguards the separation of powers. No one wants Congress to have to resort to arrest of recalcitrant executive officials and then be questioned about whether it has authority to do so or to shut down the federal government only to have its appropriations limitations then ignored by the executive. At bottom, for the separation of powers to work, there has to be a judicial backstop. History shows Congress doesn't need to resort to litigation often, but the tradition of compromise and accommodations will cease to function if the doors to the court are closed, even in circumstances as extreme as these. And we're happy to answer any questions about McGahn or Mnuchin or the merits in either case.
Let me make sure my colleagues don't have any final questions of your side. Thank you, Ms. Barbero, and to your co-counsel, Mr. Letter, and thank you, Mr. Mupon. We appreciate your arguments this morning. These cases are submitted.